have his say. That's another fine mess you've gotten us into, Ollie. In other news, a stirring message from the King remembering his mama, who was born 100 years ago today.
Much about the times we now live in, I suspect, may have troubled her deeply, but I take heart from her belief that goodness will always prevail.
Is that a coded message about Andrew, Mountbatten, Windsor? Core, there's been a change at the top of Apple.
From the moment iPhone was introduced, it reinvented the phone and set a new standard for the entire industry. We've continued to push boundaries with design.
So who is going to replace the chief executive, former chief executive, Tim Cook? And to schools here, phones will be banned in England schools under change of laws. But how exactly will that be put into practice? Those stories and more follow the 7 o'clock news on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 7 o'clock, the former head of the Foreign Office will publicly defend his actions before MPs this morning over the Lord Mandelson vetting row. Sir Ollie Robbins was sacked last week after his department was blamed for allowing him to bypass a failed security check. Sir Keir Starmer insists he was kept in the dark over the vetting ahead of the peer being made US ambassador. Former Deputy Cabinet Secretary Helen McNamara has told LBC she believes Sir Ollie has been thrown under the bus.
When you go through a security vetting process, there are a lot of questions. The people doing that security vetting have said, we're really not sure about this. At that point, back in January and February 2025, the civil service was under no illusion that what the Prime Minister wanted was this man to become the American ambassador. And what they did is what is normal in these circumstances, which is mitigate the risks.
Iran's chief negotiator has cast fresh doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the United States will go ahead in Pakistan. Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf says Tehran won't accept negotiations under the shadow of threats from America. The ceasefire between the US and Iran is due to expire tomorrow. A study has found at least two school-aged children a month die from knife injuries in England. Most deaths are as a result of a single stab wound. The findings have come from a report by the Bristol Medical School, which is the first national analysis of its kind. Teaching unions have welcomed plans to force schools in England to ban mobile phones. MPs could vote this week on an amendment to the school's bill, which would prohibit devices by law. Under current guidance, headteachers can ignore the advice if they disagree. And the King has released a message remembering his late mother, Queen Elizabeth II, on what would have been her 100th birthday.
Her near century was one of remarkable change, and yet, through each passing decade, through every transformation, she remained constant, steadfast, and wholly devoted to the people she served.
In the video, Charles suggested that his mother would have been troubled by some current events, but would have also looked for the positives. The royal family are taking part in a number of events today, including the official opening of a new memorial garden in London's Regent Park. In the city, the FTSE 100 will reopen later at 10,609. It closed down 58 points. Yesterday, the pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for the north of Scotland, a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
In a world of noise and uncertainty, IG is the investment platform that backs you. Take our flexible stocks ISA, which gives you the freedom to withdraw funds anytime and replace them in the same tax year, all without losing your £20,000 tax-free allowance. And if that's not enough, pay no commission on your stocks, shares and ETFs when you invest with IG. IG. Trade. Invest. Progress. Your capital's at risk. Other fees may apply. Tax treatment depends on individual circumstances and is subject to change.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
Good morning, it's 4 minutes after seven on Tuesday, April the 21st. The case for the defence is laid out by the lawyer, Sir Keir Starmer, but are you buying it? We'll give you full details on that, and we'll be hearing from leading Conservative politician Sir James Cleverly in just a few moments. Staying with Prime Ministerial matters, here he is calling a ban on mobile phones in schools completely unnecessary. This is in exchange with Kemi Badenoch in March of last year.
Why did Labour MPs vote against banning phones in schools last week?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Because it's completely unnecessary.
And now another U-turn, enough to make you giddy. It would appear it's on the way, but how exactly will it work? Staying with our younger people, this shocking research that shows the high number of crimes, at least two children die each month from knife injuries in England. Dr. Jade Lavelle is a senior lecturer in social and public policy at the University of Bristol and an author of that study.
At school, they were having difficulties, maybe engaging in violence, and often then they were met with exclusion and discipline.
In London, more strikes on the way. We'll give you the background to that. And also in London, an attempt by the Metropolitan Police to crack down on shop theft or shoplifting. Here's PC Danielle Pike showing LBC some of the new technology.
She's stolen £59 worth of goods. I could follow this person on it to then see if he's then attended another store, which would then give me a notification to say that she's then hit somewhere else.
Pass a poignant message from the King. The King's speech concerning 100 years since the birth of Queen Elizabeth II. We'll give you full details on that later in the show.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
It was meant to be the moment that the Prime Minister would set right exactly what happened over the Mandelson affair, but did it, like me, leave more questions than answers? Questions such as, he was keen to express his sympathy for Epstein's victims, but why on earth did he appoint him in the first place? If you knew that Peter Mandelson had a relationship with a dead paedophile, why would you appoint him in the first place if you had such sympathy? That doesn't make sense. Why would you choose to ignore the written advice from Lord Case a month prior to announcing the appointment of Peter Mandelson, that there should be monitoring? Why would you choose to ignore that? Having chosen to ignore it, and knowing the colourful background of one Lord, or Peter, now Lord Mandelson, why would you not monitor it and ask how's it going? Or, as Diane Abbott, affectionately known as the Mother of the House, said, why didn't he ask? Watching, listening and reporting now, LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark. Morning, Sasha.
Morning, Nick. Yes, yesterday it was very much judgment day for the Prime Minister over this issue, this whole Mandelson saga, which has now lasted 4 months. He faced MPs in a 2.5 hour long Commons performance where he claimed that this was all the fault of officials in the Foreign Office.
It beggars belief that throughout the whole timeline of events, officials in the Foreign Office saw fit to withhold this information from the most senior ministers in our system in government. That is not how the vast majority of people in this country expect politics, government, or accountability to work.
The Prime Minister said he was furious that he was not told that Mandelson had failed those checks. He apologised again for appointing him in the first place, but he insisted that he did not mislead MPs.
No, I did not mislead the House of Commons. I accept that information that I should have had and information that the House should have been before the House, but I did not mislead the House, and that's why I've set out the account in full.
But the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch, all but said she did not believe the Prime Minister's version of events.
A former Director of Public Prosecutions is so lacking in curiosity that he chose to ask no questions about the vetting process. He asked no questions about Mandelson's relationship with Epstein. He asked no questions about the security risk Mandelson posed. Apparently, he didn't even speak to Peter Mandelson before his appointment. It doesn't appear that he asked any questions at all. Why? Because he didn't want to know.
And Nick, soon it became clear the depth of anger amongst senior MPs and crucially some Labour MPs too. We heard from the independent Mother of the House, Diane Abbott, who asked why he didn't ask about Mandelson's vetting.
What this House wants to know is why, knowing Peter Mandelson's history, going back now 30 years, and given what has been known, it's one thing to say, as he insists on saying, nobody told me. Nobody told me anything. Nobody told me. The question is, why didn't the Prime Minister ask? Yeah.
And Nick, amongst the MPs I've spoken to in the last 24 hours, most of them say they think the Prime Minister has survived to live another day. Despite his slightly shaky performance, he won't face an imminent threat. Many of them, of course, believe he is on the way out yesterday. But Nick, of course, will be hearing today from Sir Ollie Robbins. He is, of course, the Foreign Office official at the heart of this row. Lots of questions still to be answered. Why did he pass Mandelson when the Czechs recommended him not to? Were Starmer and others pressuring that vetting to be rubber-stamped? And did he tell anyone in government? Another day of high drama ahead.
Indeed. It's only half time, and that's around 9 o'clock. We hear from Sir Ollie Robbins. To borrow a line from Laurel and Hardy, that's another fine mess you've gotten me into, Ollie. Natasha Clark is LBC's political editor reporting. Let's bring into the conversation former Foreign Secretary, Shadow Housing Secretary, leading Conservative MP, Sir James, cleverly joining me now. Sir James, has it gone away? Good morning.
Nick, good morning. This problem has not gone away. If anything, I think the Prime Minister's performance in the chamber yesterday has made the situation worse. And Diane Abbott asked the question out loud that a number of us were trying to get the Prime Minister to answer. Because he kept saying, oh, this person didn't tell me, and that person didn't tell me, and this person didn't tell me. But he refused to answer why he didn't ask. We all knew that Mandelson was a high-risk appointment. We all knew he'd maintained a friendship with Epstein. He had business interests with a Russian arms manufacturing company after the initial invasion of Crimea by Russia. We knew he had deep business interests with China. We knew that he was a security risk. This was public domain information, and yet the Prime Minister didn't bother to ask anyone if the vetting process was okay. And had he asked, it would have been clear that it wasn't.
Something else that the Conservative Party leader, Kemi Badenoch, touched on was why he chose to ignore the advice from the former Cabinet Secretary, Lord Case, who requested prior information to allow vetting to proceed. That was a month before Lord Mandelson's appointment was announced. And again, he chose not to answer as to why he took that path of action. Sir James.
Well, this is the point that Kemi was making. It is absolutely clear that the Prime Minister misled the House. Now, if we're going to be generous, we can say he inadvertently misled the House, but the fact is he misled the House. He said unambiguously, publicly, on a number of occasions, that the full process had been followed, as it is with all ambassadorial appointments. That was his phraseology. We now know, because of that letter from Lord Case, that he did not follow the proper procedure. That is a clear misleading of the House. And he refused even to concede that.
Where does it go next, lastly, Sir James?
Well, Sir Ollie,
I know we're all watching and waiting for Sir Ollie Robbins in a little over 2 hours, a little under 2 hours' time, Sir James.
Yeah. So Sir Ollie Robinson will be in front of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. And it's being trailed that he will basically say that he the whole system was under pressure to basically retrofit the appointment that Number 10 had already decided upon. By the time Sir Ollie was recruited, remember, Peter Mandelson had already been appointed. That announcement had happened, and Ollie was clearly told, sort it out, make it work.
And Sir James, do you think, bear in mind using the privilege of the House of Commons, it was suggested Mandelson might have leaked news of his appointment, which kind of forced Starmer into the corner in which he found himself. Any credibility to that, Sir James?
Well, look, I only one man knows,
I suppose.
Exactly. So I can't know for sure, but I would not be surprised. Look, Peter Mandelson's an operator. And funnily enough, the previous government line that Peter Kyle said when interviewed a couple of months ago, he basically said, look, we all knew that Mandelson was a high-risk appointment, but we all thought the risk was worth it. That was the line that they were taking. Now that that appointment has blown up so spectacularly, somehow they're trying to revisit their justification by saying, oh, nobody knew that Peter was a potential security risk. That is just not credible. And I think today, with Sir Ollie's evidence to the Select Committee and the emergency debate that Kemi has demanded, we're going to see just how tissue paper thin that excuse really is.
Grateful for your time. Thank you. Sir James Cleverly, former Foreign Secretary, now Shadow Housing Secretary, 13 after 7. Listening, Preet Gill, who's a Labour MP for Birmingham Edgbaston. Thank you very much for coming on. Do you think your Prime Minister now has done enough? Has he settled whatever nerves there might have been among his colleagues on the back benches? Morning to you.
Good morning. Well, look, I thought it was really important that the Prime Minister opened his statement yesterday with an apology. He accepted that he should never have appointed Peter Mandelson. I think that's right. I know that the Parliamentary Labour Party was really looking for Keir to make such a statement. I think it's important to say, though, that the vetting process is independent. It's got to be, because you want people to cooperate. And, you know, you've got to... it's quite absurd. I was on the doors this weekend. It's quite absurd, though, that we have a vetting process which is about protecting people, and that's absolutely right. But the fact that the Prime Minister has not been told that somebody has passed vetting is something quite absurd to all of us. But clearly what came out from the statement, that this is a process that exists within the Foreign Office, because actually all of the departments, when somebody hasn't passed their vetting, accept the decision, bar the Foreign Office. Now, it does raise a question about, is this a normal culture? Because why would it be that a permanent secretary, knowing full well everything that's going on, and that's in the public domain, why wouldn't he want to flag with ministers and the Prime Minister, who is fundamentally accountable to the House and the public, is quite shocking.
But can I reverse that? And to use the words of your senior colleague, Diane Abbott, or former colleague, I'm so sorry, former Labour, why didn't he ask? Why didn't he, Sir Keir, ask with such a high-risk appointment?
Well, I think he did, and I think that's what he set out in his statement, is how many opportunities the Foreign Office actually had to flag this issue. Let's not forget, the Cabinet Secretary, Chris Wormald, was asked to undertake a review. Even at the time that he undertook that review, the Foreign Office did not share the information that was clearly asked. I mean, I think there is a culture within the Foreign Office, clearly, that this is seen to be quite the norm, because why would it be that on such a high-profile issue like this, the Permanent Secretary did not think it was right to flag with a minister or the Foreign Secretary? I think most people listening to this will equally find this quite absurd, that the Prime Minister of this country is fundamentally accountable to the public, and he wasn't informed.
But lastly, he comes out more like Manuel from Fawlty Towers, I know nothing, than the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. He never knows anything if it goes against him.
Well, look, that's not true. He's got officials, you know, that he trusts. He's got people around him that have got to carry out the duties and undertake the work that he's asking them to. He's relying on integrity, because, of course, he can't be over the whole detail. I think what this situation has really meant is that the Prime Minister has to review this process. He's already put in place measures where the FCDO can no longer override such decisions. I think that is absolutely right. You know, people have got to have confidence in our politics and our democracy. And I think what this has alluded to is this is quite a precarious situation. Now, I think, you know, the Prime Minister did not mislead the House. He's a man of great integrity. I think what he set out, most people will quite, you know, like I said, will find absurd. Okay. And you know, pleased that he is putting in a robust process in place.
Grateful for your time this morning. Thank you, Preet. Preet Gill, Labour MP for Birmingham Edgbaston, laying out the two sides there. Obviously, a Labour supporter and a Conservative opponent. What do you take from yesterday, whether you listened, watched it in full, or, of course, have listened to the news reports? We'll take your views on that. And then later in the show, we mark the 100th anniversary of the birth of a monarch.
To you, living in new surroundings, we send a message of true sympathy.
Queen Elizabeth II, one of her first public addresses, speaking as a 14-year-old during the Second World War. 7:17, LBC News headlines. Dominic Ellis.
The former head of the Foreign Office will publicly defend his actions before MPs this morning over the Lord Mandelson vetting row. Iran's chief negotiator has cast fresh doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the US will go ahead. And data just released shows the rate of UK unemployment fell from 5.2% to 4.9% in the 3 months to February. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for northern Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. There's only one lane open on the M4 eastbound at Junction 13 at Newbury because a lorry was on fire earlier and the exit slip road is closed as well to the A34 and it's very slow on the main carriageway. In Yall, the Kingston Road remains closed northbound after an accident and in Peckham, Queen's Road stays closed both ways. On the train, southern services are delayed to and from London Bridge. Thames Link are delayed at St Pancras. The Windrush line remains suspended between Sydenham and West Croydon and the Mildmay line can't run as well between Wilson Junction and Richmond. A reminder that the tube strike starts today at midday, which means there will be severe disruption on all the lines through this afternoon and evening.
This is LBC.
Right, who's all in for Cancer Research UK's Race for Life? Sunday Leaguers, dog lovers, bait clubbers, banker dancers, baby ravers, potters. Whether you walk it, jog it, or run it, go all in against cancer. All in to help fund life-saving research. Sign up to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event from just $14.99. Search Race for Life. Prices vary by event distance and participant age.
Call Nick Ferrari now. 0345 6060973. This is LBC.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
People ask me, what's my good place? Checking out the food trucks on the weekend with my partner. And knowing that Pension B helped me combine my pensions into one easy-to-manage plan.
Tacos?
Tacos.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident when investing your capital is at risk.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973.
21 minutes after 7, coming to your calls in just a moment. You can imagine what most... I won't share all of the front pages, but most of them are, of course, going with events in the House of Commons yesterday. It's everyone's fault, but his is the fairly punchy front page of the Daily Mail. Even the Labour-supporting Daily Mirror has it on its front page. They chose not to tell me. The other way you could do that, of course, folks, is he chose not to ask. And the Daily Telegraph picking up on the line that we did. I know many MPs will find these facts to be incredible. You've certainly got that right. The I has a similar line. I know my story sounds incredible. I remind you, we are effectively, if you're a sporting man or woman, we're effectively at half-time here because we've got Sir Ollie Robbins, another fine mess you've gotten me into, Ollie. We've got Sir Ollie Robbins coming up at 9 o'clock and we will take at least the start of that live and then we'll make a judgment call as to... Well, really, how far and how deep down they decide to drill. The front page of the LBC app is telling you all about that. Starmer on collision course with sacked civil servant. That is, of course, Sir Ollie Robbins. Let's get a view on that. Seamus in Wallington, whether you heard it, whether you listened to the news bulletins or whether you're reading it this morning, has he done enough? Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, Nick. No, I don't think he has, and I think it's... I've listened to a lot of Labour MPs over the last 2 days coming on and completely gaslighting all of us as if we are really stupid and can't see what's going on.
What is going on, sir? What is going on?
Well, I'd really ask everyone to move away from... Look at why he failed his vetting. He failed his vetting because of links to Chinese and Russian business.
We believe. I need to throw in there, that has been widely asserted and has been reported, but we can't say it as fact. But go ahead, you're allowed to posit it as an idea. Go ahead, Seamus.
It was on the front page of the Sunday Times, a fantastic article.
Okay, I have told you, because it's on the front page, it was in quotes, quote marks, which, Seamus, means it is not a proven fact. So please don't make me go there again. You can continue to say that, but when they put it in quotes, it means they've not got definitive proof. So let's go on with your point. I really want to hear what you want to say. On you go, Seamus.
Except, it alleges that whilst he was ambassador, not having failed security clearance, his PR company, of which he's got significant shares held in, or did have, was paid over £3 million by a Chinese company called Wu Zaptech, who have been banned in America since for stealing copyright.
What do you find, lastly, Seamus, the most baffling or troubling aspect of this whole saga?
There is no way an ex-DPP, a forensic barrister, with his experience and his clinical mind, would not have known or even asked the question. It is not credible, Nick, at all, in any way or form.
Totally with you on that. I mean, the Mirror saying they chose not to tell me. The headline is, he chose not to ask, having appointed someone such as Mandelson, who had already had to resign, as Diane Abbott pointed out, had already had to resign twice in his career. Seamus, thank you. Have yourself a good day. 7:24, more on this to come. But let's go to other stories. And the troubling story that SAS soldiers, Special Air Force soldiers, are resigning in significant numbers over fears they'll be subjected to witch hunts by human rights lawyers. Multiple sources claiming that personnel from across 22 SAS, the Army's most elite fighting force, applying for premature voluntary release. Now, the paper that's breaking this, The Telegraph, is withholding the exact figure for security reasons, and obviously I will respect that and not try and get a number, but several SAS sources have described the recent losses as significant and even going as far to say a threat to national security. To Lieutenant Colonel Richard Williams, who's a former commanding officer of 22 SAS and joins me now. Thanks for coming on board, sir. Okay, what are their fears and how valid are those fears in your eyes? Good morning.
Well, their fears are more in response to what's happening. As we know, and you've been observing, or everyone's been observing, in Northern Ireland, the retrospective application of European human rights law has reopened cases into a number of, or reopened investigations and thereby cases into a number of actions conducted when that armed insurgency was active before the Good Friday Agreement. There's also been individuals taken and arrested in front of their children in similarly spectacular circumstances to that which has befell the Australian Victoria Cross winner for actions that they have alleged to have committed in violation from that human rights law in Syria. And there's the ongoing investigation into alleged offences in Afghanistan, where, again, the human rights law is playing a part. And so for experienced SAS men who've got time to serve yet, and the service is in all of our service, quite clearly they're sitting and thinking, is it worth it? Is the next operation that I do justifiably and under control and in accordance with my rules of engagement going to lead to such appalling follow-on? And so justifiably, a number of them are walking to spend time with their family and prepare to defend themselves against what they think are unsubstantiated allegations.
Lieutenant Colonel, this is said to be a threat to national security. Can I ask you, how big a threat in your estimation?
Well, special forces aren't the whole of defence, but they are a very niche part of defence that operates across what the jargon is the spectrum of war. Now, the far end of the spectrum would be if our country was invaded like has happened in Ukraine and we were all at it in defence. But as we know in our lifetimes, war or combat is fought at lower levels of intensity than that. Counter-terrorism in the UK in support of the civil powers, the police or the security services, is very common and very often. And to those circumstances, specialist military capability trained and demonstrated by events such as the rescue of the hostages in the Iranian embassy in the 1980s was developed. And so if you weaken that, and you can weaken it by numbers, but you can weaken it by how they operate, doubts in these operators' minds, you make it easier for terrorists, and thereby, by definition, you make us and our national security weaker.
So there's a terror threat implied here, sir, Lieutenant Colonel.
Yes, sir. Yeah, there is a constant terror threat to the UK and to its interests abroad, as is demonstrated by the many events over the years, both stopped terrorist attacks and terrorist attacks that are successful. And I'm just giving you two examples. But there's one other area that's very important in the transatlantic relationship, because it's not well known, but the American Tier 1 Special Forces, that's the top end of their military, is numerically the same as our Tier 1 Special Forces. Their Delta Force and their SEAL Team 6 produce or stand at approximately same number as the combination of SAS and SBS. And so it's a remarkable thing that a country of our size, with greatly diminished armed forces of our size, provides the same numbers as a country with substantial forces, an extraordinary amount of resources, as the United States of America. Now, those two forces, American Tier 1 Special Forces and British Tier 1 Special Forces, over the years have operated together, and they've needed to. America brings a lot of resource in terms of capability like helicopters and drones and so on and so forth that we don't have, not to their scale anyway, but we bring numbers. And so where it has been appropriate, where there's been national policy aligned, the Americans and the British have operated together, where we've made a real difference.
Lastly then, and briefly, this is putting the nation at risk.
It is, yeah, exactly. And I'm sorry to go on too far, but
not at all.
If what happens, that niche and an important capability is diminished by these decisions, it actually puts national security at risk. And that's just talking about special forces. You can imagine the impact across the wider forces too.
Grateful for your time this morning, sir. Thank you. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Williams, former commanding officer of 22 SAS, spelling out the actions of that. Daniel, I hope you can hold to the other side of the news. You want to give me your view on what we heard from Sir Keir Starmer on the Mandelson affair. I remind you, it is effectively half-time, second half, around 9 o'clock this morning, and you will hear it live, at least the start live with me. We'll monitor as it goes through. And then in the world of business, a surprise here.
From the moment iPhone was introduced, it reinvented the phone and set a new standard for the entire industry. We've continued to push boundaries with design.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook unveiling the iPhone 17, September of last year. He now steps down. But why and who replaces him? Answers to those questions and more after this. 7:30, breakfast with me, Nick Ferrari, here on LBC. The news from Dominic Ellis.
The former boss of the Foreign Office, who was sacked over the Lord Mandelson vetting row, is due to give evidence to MPs this morning. Sir Ollie Robbins left his job after his department was accused of allowing the peer to bypass a failed security check. One of Iran's top negotiators has cast fresh doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the US will go ahead later. The ceasefire between the two sides is due to expire tomorrow. And a surprise drop in the unemployment rate has seen it fall to its lowest level since last summer. It's dipped from 5.2% in the 3 months to January to 4.9% for the quarter ending in February. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for the north of Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
On the latest episode of The News Agents.
Keir Starmer has come to the Commons and faced his critics. He's apologised again for appointing Peter Mandelson as our ambassador to Washington. But questions still remain about why he announced that appointment before the vetting process had even begun.
Get the latest episode of The News Agents with Emily Maitlis, John Sopel and Lewis Goodall. Listen or watch on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Tonight's EuroMillions jackpot is £126 million.
I think that deserves a whoop whoop. Whoop whoop! Thank you, faraway person.
Get in tonight's draw. EuroMillions from the National Lottery. It could be you.
Estimate your jackpot. Rules apply. 18 plus.
3, 2, 1, 0% APR on all-electric Mini Cooper. What was that, Luton? Handling is extraordinary. Centre of gravity so low. And it could be ours with a 15% deposit and 3-year term. OK, Luton, reroute me to the nearest Mini retailer now.
Land a new all-electric Mini Cooper with 0% APR. Report to your Mini retailer today. Mini UK is a credit broker. Ordered and delivered by 30th of June. PCP finance with Mini Financial Services. Subject to status. 18 plus. T's and C's apply. Mini.co.uk/Cooper.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
7.33, Daniel, you will be the first caller, but we want to get into the world of business. And off the missing list, I'm delighted to say, and back in action, surprisingly went missing while they were looking for the culprits of the calamitous Mandelson affair. Whether there's any connection, I've no idea. Christian May, editor-in-chief at City AM, rejoins us now with some employment figures. And the way I'm seeing them, actually, this is, well, it's still a problem, but it's potentially some good news. Christian, welcome back. Morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Nick. Yes, good to be back. I wasn't away keeping a low profile. I was simply on a humble holiday, and I'm delighted to be back with you.
How convenient. How convenient.
That's right. What have I stumbled back into? Well, let's start with the jobs market, as you put it. Yes, the headlines do appear positive. The unemployment rate officially falling from 5.2% to 4.9%. Well, that sounds rather good, doesn't it? So why is it then that all the economists and analysts in my inbox over the last half hour since these figures were announced are pretty gloomy? Well, we have to unpick it. First of all, that period in which they say the unemployment rate fell comes in before, of course, the crisis in the Middle East, the Iran war, and the devastating consequences on energy costs and business and consumer confidence. So in the same way that we saw figures showing higher than expected UK economic growth in the first couple of months of this year and towards the end of last year, nobody now expects that to continue. And we can feel some sympathy for the Chancellor and for the government in that regard. Looking at the figures more closely, the market, in fact, for jobs has taken a bit of a turn for the worse. Vacancies have fallen in the UK economy to their lowest level in nearly 5 years. The number of vacancies slumped by about another 30,000. So that's now about 700,000 vacancies available in the UK economy. That is low and falling. Vacancies in 14 out of the 18 sectors tracked by the ONS have fallen. The number of payrolled employees did, in fact, drop. So what accounts then for the fall in the unemployment rate? Well, it's being pointed out that this comes alongside a rise in the number of people who have declared themselves not actively seeking work. And if you're not actively seeking work, then you're not contributing to the unemployment list. So large numbers of people who are no longer actively looking for work, particularly students who are not looking for work alongside or outside their studies. And this coincides with facts from the figures this morning that show that it is part-time work which is drying up particularly quickly, as it is for people in a continuation of a rather gloomy trend under the age of 34. So although that headline figure might be reassuring, it is already out of date, and people are anticipating that the unemployment rate is going to climb again. In fact, we saw over the last day or so, I was reading this on the plane back from California just to cheer myself up, that there is an expectation that the rate of unemployment could climb as high as 5.8% by the end of this summer.
One area that's had its problems with employment is the hospitality sector. And as you point out on the front page of City AM today, when we think of tube strikes, I automatically think of inconvenience for people getting to and from work. But actually, it's a big dent in some particular business, isn't it, Christian?
Well, it's a huge blow to London's pubs, restaurants, tourism sector in particular. You think of all those ancillary businesses from sandwiches to shoe repairs that normally rely on regular commuter footfall. I'm always struck by the number of people that do, in fact, make it into London and into the city on a tube strike day at a glance. But nevertheless, it will be considerably down. People will work from home for the next few days. And it's London's pubs and restaurants in particular bracing for a knock of as much as 40% of their daily sales from this week. And this week, of course, For some people, it is the last few days of the Easter holiday, and a lot of people who perhaps would have come into London now won't. I think of the museums and other tourist-related parts of the economy. I was talking to some cheerful Americans in LAX airport yesterday who were very excited for their first trip to London, had to break it to them that it's going to be a little bit tricky with a tube strike, but I'm sure they'll still have a good time. But about 40% of Zone 1 pubs and bar sales could be wiped out by these strikes. And this, of course, comes as the hospitality sector and its leaders and industry bodies point out that they are still struggling with all sorts of other cost increases, whether that's through energy costs, employment costs, business rates. So it couldn't have come at a worse time. There'll be huge frustration and disappointment in many parts of London's economy, not just the hospitality sector, as these strikes bite.
Lastly, who might be getting ready to sign the bill for William Hill?
Well, we know, don't we, that the owner of William Hill, let's evoke, said after the budget that saw taxes increasing on the gambling sector that it would have to now explore a sale or a breakup of its own business because of a £140-odd million hit from the Chancellor's tax changes. Now, that'd be one of the reasons that is driving their strategic changes. But news confirmed over the weekend that that company behind the likes of William Hill, which put itself up for sale at the end of last year, is now looking at a possible bid from an Athens-based Intralot, a lottery and casino company, which is controlled by America's Bally Corporation. Now, the offer is at about a 30% premium to its closing share price on Friday, which makes it on paper look reasonably attractive, and share prices closed up a little bit yesterday as the news was digested. Could be an all-share merger. And they have now until, I think, the middle or endish of May to make a firm bid for the William Hill owner or walk away.
Grateful for that. Good to have you back. Talk around the same time tomorrow. Christian May, Editor-in-Chief at City AM. Daniel, as I've said already, you will be the next caller, but I'm going to stay with business stories because there is a big one, which, of course, will be covered in City AM, but I did ask Christian to leave off because we've got expert opinion on it now with the news that Apple, the new chief executive to replace Tom Cook, has been named as John Ternus. Mr. Cook will step down after 15 years of leading, well, it says here, the technology giant. My goodness me, its economy is also that of a small country, isn't it? Will Guyard, LBC's technology correspondent, joins me now. Just remind the listeners then exactly what's happened and then interpret it for us, if you would. Will, good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Yes, so Tim Cook took over Apple from the visionary Steve Jobs about 15 years ago and has guided the company through the kind of second half of the iPhone age, if you will, because Steve Jobs was the guy who stood up there with the idea and created it, and has actually brought a lot of stability to the company. Many people forget that Apple was a tremendous boom and bust business in the years before. It created the kind of a premium home computer market, then collapsed, then Steve Jobs came back, and then there was pressure to keep the company performing after the launch of the iPhone and the iPad, both of which were devised under Steve Jobs. So he's done 15 years at the top of the company, but the challenge was always going to be who's next, because he had a reputation of being a bit of an operations guy. He was the guy that was sort of making sure all the supply chains worked and stuff, whereas somebody like Steve Jobs was sat in an office sending rude one-word emails to people and coming up with incredible product ideas. That's not something that Tim Cook ever did, and they've replaced him. The new guy is somebody that's worked at product at Apple for about 20 or so years, mm-hmm. So he knows his way around the company's product lines, but is he going to be coming up with sort of genius ideas that you got from the Steve Jobs Sir Johnny Ive duo, the British designer that worked with Steve Jobs to create all the iconic ideas? That's still to be seen.
Lastly, this is an industry where, as if you don't keep reinventing, you die. I remind our listeners, BlackBerry, Nokia, you have to keep on the cutting edge, don't you, Will?
You do. You do have to keep on the cutting edge. And that's been one of the concerns with Apple. It's spent a huge amount of money on creating these headsets known as the Apple Vision. They are literally the premium sports car of any of these kind of virtual reality headsets, costing $3,500 each. They were amazing, but they've been very quickly surpassed. People now want stuff that looks like normal spectacles and doesn't have as much technology in it. And Apple haven't yet announced anything in that place. So that's where we think they're going next, into health and into glasses and wearable technology.
We will wait and watch. Will Guyatt, thank you. LBC's technology correspondent, 7:42. Daniel in Goldersgreen, your summation of what you heard yesterday from the Prime Minister. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honour. To use a legal analogy here in the Court of Public Opinion on LBC, I'm going to invite you and your listeners to arrive at the conclusion that Keir Starmer is guilty as charged.
Go on, go ahead.
So, Nick, we now know that the most senior civil servant in this country, Sir Simon Case, in September 2024, sent the Prime Minister a memo saying, I strongly advise you to complete security vetting first before you appoint Peter Mandelson. The Prime Minister overrode that. Mm-hmm. So the Prime Minister's central defence that due process was followed is a complete pack of lies. Due process was not followed.
Because had he followed the advice from now Lord then Sir Simon Case, he would have given the necessary authorisation for the vetting to take place prior to announcement.
Correct. Exactly that. And this is so serious, Nick, for you and your listeners, everyone in this country. The Prime Minister of the United Kingdom appointed someone, a three times disgraced former minister, who is a friend of a convicted paedophile, to the most intelligence-sensitive ambassadorial position in our country, who had access to the most secret top-level intelligence before he was security vetted, which he in fact failed. And Nick, that is unacceptable.
Having then taken that decision, having chosen to ignore the advice from the former cabinet secretary, how surprising or otherwise is it that he appears to show no curiosity as to how the vetting was going, or, to quote Diane Abbott, why didn't he ask?
Well, absolutely, Nick. It's not surprising at all, because just a matter of weeks ago, we saw in the press a leaked message from Labour Party insiders saying that Keir Starmer is completely devoid of curiosity. He never asks questions. He has no curiosity. He has no interest in inquiring about anything. And this is supposed to be someone who purports himself to be a forensic lawyer. Nick, it is an absolute load of nonsense, and the Prime Minister has to resign.
Daniel in Golders Green, thank you. Gavin in Cambridge. Gavin, your summation of what you saw or heard yesterday.
Yeah, hello, Nick. It's pretty much like the same guy, really. I mean, all these years we've been having ambassadors to the US, we've never had this problem before.
No.
So,
We've probably never had a high-risk appointment like this before, though, and that was...
Yeah, but we all knew. We all knew what he was like. And Diane Abbott said it yesterday. It's been going on since the 90s.
Yep. And therefore, do you think, in a sense, Sir Keir Starmer is trying to hide behind this vetting process? Because the reality is, the man, Mandelson, should never have been considered for the post in the first place.
Well, of course, that's right, yeah. That's exactly it. It's just... the man doesn't know what he's doing.
No, well... He's obsessed with process. Gavin, thanks for your input. We'll have more calls on this. Later in the show, the idea from the government that they will move towards banning smartphones in schools.
We are committing to tabling an amendment in lieu, which will place the existing guidance on a statutory footing, on the face of the bill, creating a clear legal requirement for schools.
That's Education Minister Baroness Smith telling the House of Lords. We'll have more on that later in the show. Ed Miliband talking about the need for, yes, net zero. He's the other side of the headlines. 7:45 LBC News. Dominic Ellis.
The former head of the Foreign Office will publicly defend his actions over the Lord Mandelson vetting row when he faces MPs this morning. One of Iran's top negotiators has cast doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the US will go ahead later, and teaching unions have welcomed plans to force schools in England to ban mobile phones. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK, outbreaks of rain for northern Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. Severe delays on the M25, anti-clockwise on the Kent stretch to the Dartford Tunnel. It's slow from Junction 2 at the A2. And that was after an accident and two lanes stay closed. Two lanes are still closed on the M4 eastbound just before Junction 13 at Cheveley. It's because a lorry was on fire earlier. The fire's now out, but two lanes stay closed and the exit slip road is also closed to the A34. On the trains, well, LNER services are delayed between King's Cross and Peterborough. That's because a train's broken down. There's a reduced service for Southern between London Bridge and Crystal Palace and also to Norwood Junction. And just a reminder that the tube strike starts at midday today, so there will be severe disruption.
This is LBC.
3, 2, 1. EasyJet's Big Orange Sale is now on, with up to £400 off package holidays and up to 20% off flights. Book now at EasyJet.com. Get out there. Selected dates and flights, sale ends 5th of May. Holidays minimum spend and ATOL protected. T's and C's apply.
Call
Nick Ferrari now. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Have you spotted anything?
Only seagulls. Are you sure this beach is a nature reserve?
Well, the sign said nature this way. Hey, what's that big bird over there? Flapping its wings, unusual markings.
You sure that sign didn't say naturists?
Oi, this is a nudist beach.
Ooh. Now, where are my binoculars?
Cheryl?
Struggling to read in the sun? Get 2-for-1 at Specsavers and make prescription sunglasses your second pair. From £70 with standard single vision lenses to the same prescription. Terms and conditions apply. See in store for details.
You know what you're getting with a wedding? Wedding hats. A baby in a waistcoat crying throughout the vows. Themed tables. Awkward best man speech. The plus one.
Hello.
People dancing in a circle. Ruined rental suit. Sometimes in life, you just know what you're getting, like a luxury bed and a great night's sleep. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
Fever Tree Ginger Beer. There's no one quite like you, is there? That fiery character. Warming undertones. Mixed, you make a spirited Moscow Mule. But even on your own, you still have the most delectable kick. Fever Tree. Straight up or mixed. It's a matter of taste.
Time to bring your out-of-date kitchen up to date. Wix has over 80 kitchen styles, so you can find the perfect one. Book your free kitchen design appointment at Wix.
Tonight's EuroMillions jackpot is £126 million.
I think that deserves a whoop-whoop. Whoop-whoop! Thank you, faraway person.
Get in tonight's draw. EuroMillions from the National Lottery. It could be you.
Estimated jackpot. Rules apply. 18 plus.
Take Irish Ferries from Dover to Calais, where your pet travels in the pet lounge. You'd be barking not to. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060 973.
It's 11 minutes before 8, and as the rows and controversies continue out of what has happened in the past, one government minister, indeed Secretary of State, is determined to position the country correctly for the future. And he will speak, he, Ed Miliband, will speak at the Good Growth Foundation's National Growth Debate. So let's bring into the conversation now Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero, Ed Miliband, joining me. Good to have you on, Secretary of State. Briefly, what are we going to hear later today? Good morning to you.
So Nick, what I'm going to be talking about today is we've seen two fossil fuel crises in the last 5 years. Russia invading Ukraine, the Iran war, prices going through the roof as a result of us being at the behest of oil and gas markets we don't control. And there is one clear answer to this, and that is to drive further and faster on clean energy. That's about more renewables and nuclear. It's about giving people access to heat pumps and electric vehicles and businesses being able to electrify. And it's also about something else, which is actually doing more to separate out the electricity price we pay from the gas price. And it's all about making sure that we do much, much more to protect people in our country and indeed our economy from this unstable world that we live in.
But of course, currently, only 5% of our power is generated through solar and other sources. 95% comes from fossil fuel.
No, that's wrong. That's wrong. Last year, 50% of our power came from renewable sources, compared to 7% in 2010. About a third comes from gas.
Well, certainly you can't put wind or solar power in your tank, can you? You talk about prices going through the roof. What can you do about relief now with the Iran or Strait of Hormuz crisis?
Well, look, the first and most important thing we need to do, Nick, is to end the war.
Right.
And get the strait reopened. And that is what we are focused on as a government. I'm really concerned about what is happening to petrol and diesel prices because I know it's really hard for people. That's why we've frozen the duty. That's why the Chancellor's frozen the duty. She is continuing
to. Expires in a few months, as you know.
Yes, and she's got a decision to make, obviously, about what happens
which
after that.
Which way will that go, do you imagine? Do you think it should go, Mr. Miliband?
Look, I'm not going to... I know more than to sort of start speculating about the Chancellor's tax policy because she's got to make those decisions, but she recognises, as I recognise, the real stresses that people are under, obviously. She will obviously look at the situation.
Then why not do more? Other countries in Europe are either freezing the amount that is taken in levies or freezing VAT or giving certain holidays on... And yet, I know you're going to reference the freeze, but many would say we're not doing enough.
Well, look, the Chancellor... Look, I know from my conversations with her, she looks really closely at these issues. I think the important thing to say, though, is that fiscal stability is so important for us as a country. Because if we end up in a situation, and I know everyone talks about Liz Truss, but it is worth remembering, if we end up in a situation where we make decisions which don't add up, and then the bond markets punish us, and we have interest rates going through the roof, nobody is going to thank us for it. I totally get what you're saying. I totally get the situation that people are facing,
What is the price of a litre of diesel today?
It's about 192p.
It's almost 1994, an unleaded 15797 from the RAC.
And it's gone up exponentially. Well, it's gone up 50p. Yeah, it's gone up 50.
And we're not even talking about heating oil. And again, my listeners say, why does the government do? Why should you, not you personally, the government benefit from the increased tax take when businesses and businessmen and women are finding it so tough?
Look, just let me unpack that for a second. On heating oil, we put aside money for people in particularly difficult circumstances.
Only the most vulnerable.
That's true, the most vulnerable. Just on your point about benefiting, just want to be really, really clear about this. There is no windfall as a result of this, because any extra money that the Chancellor or the public coffers get from VAT is offset by reduced spending elsewhere, which obviously, unfortunately, people are having to make. So, look, I'm not coming on saying there's nothing that can be done, because we one of the decisions the Chancellor's announcing today, and it's just come out, is raising the taxes on the excess profits of the companies, the energy companies that are making money actually from the linking of the gas price to nuclear and renewables, and that money is going to be used, the Chancellor is saying, to help families and businesses. She announced last week help for businesses that are facing difficulties. But look, I hear what you're saying. I hear the because I know it from talking to people, the difficulties people are facing in this crisis. We've got to bring the war to an end, and absolutely, we're looking at what interventions can be made.
But lastly on that, and that's a very noble intention and ambition, and I hope you do, but obviously it involves a series of other parties, not least Iran and President Trump. What you can do, and I say again, is look at directly the price of diesel unleaded in our pumps. That is something many people would say, and point to other European countries, Mr.
I hear you.
Okay. One of your greatest cheerleaders, Dale Vince, by a man behind, of course, Ecotricity, called on you yesterday to drop grants for heat pumps and spend the $2.7 billion on defence instead. How do you respond to Mr. Vince?
I don't agree with him, and let me explain why. Unless the key insight of this crisis, the key lesson of this crisis yet again, is that if we are stuck on gas and oil, we are, as we are, subject to these markets we don't control, the British people are going to be really badly affected by this. And that's why... So what's the point of a heat pump? Well, the point of a heat pump, it gets you off gas and it gets you onto electricity. And the announcement we're making... let me just make this point. The announcement we're making today to further de-link the electricity price from the gas price... And sorry, this is a bit technical, but it's the way our market works. But the Chancellor's taking measures today to de-link these prices is a way of helping to protect people if they can get onto heat pumps. We're announcing today, for example, an increase in the heat pump grant for those who use heating oil, you mentioned heating oil earlier, to £9,000, recognising the higher costs they face. So all of what we're doing, Nick, we're advancing money in social housing. All of what we're doing is to try to help people in time for next winter.
But another point made by Mr. Vince is that the current £7,500 heat pump grant goes mostly to well-off households anyway.
Well, I don't... Actually, that's not true. Lots of people...
Vince is wrong on both charges?
Yeah, he is.
Let's talk a little bit about increasing the use of the North Sea. I want to give you a list of names who say we should be doing more. They include the head of British Gas, Chris O'Shea, Greg Jackson, head of Octopus, former Prime Minister Sir Tony Blair, and Tara Singh, head of Renewables UK. They're all wrong, and you, Mr. Miliband, are right.
I'm in favour of using the North Sea.
No, increasing the North Sea, calling on more licences.
Let me explain our position. We've said we want existing oil and gas fields to be used for their lifetime. We're also announcing so-called tiebacks to those fields, so that's new production in adjacent fields. That's our position. What I don't believe is that new exploration licences will make any difference to price. It will not take a single penny off bills, Nick. It will make no difference to supply, because the North Sea is a declining basin. And I'm afraid the problem with this argument, those people who say let's drill every last... by the way, I'm not in favour of turning off the taps, but I don't agree with those people who say we should drill every last drop. Why not? because we're just going to be right back here where we were before. If we don't get off fossil fuels, Nick, but if we don't transition to clean energy, we are going to be stuck in this vicious circle of prices and markets we don't control.
But that's long term, isn't it? Why can't there be some temporary? Your ambition is a sound one, to get there in 5, 10, whatever years it might be. Why not some temporary relief to get us along the way? We're always going to need some degree of fossil fuel.
Well, that's why I think there's been a bit of a mischaracterization of our position, because we are in favor of using the North Sea, including with the so-called use of tiebacks, which industry has called for. You see, when you talk to industry about this, they don't think new exploration licenses will make any difference, any material difference, but they are in favor of the tiebacks that we've announced. So it's really important. I'm really glad to have this opportunity. We're not in favour of turning off the taps in the North Sea, but nor do we think every last drop is the answer.
One other conversation which you knew would be coming your way as the Prime Minister. Had you been Prime Minister and had been asked by Lord Case to make sure that vetting took place prior to the announcement of the most senior diplomatic role as Ambassador in Washington, would you have heeded that advice?
Well, this is complicated.
Would you have heeded that advice, Mr. Miliband?
Well, I wouldn't have appointed Peter Mandelson in the first place,
no.
As you know, because I sort of parted company with Peter Mandelson about 15 years ago when I became a Labour leader. Just on the point about Lord Case, it's really, really important to say this. Chris Wormald looked at the whole process and said the normal process was followed.
Now, how can you say that? Because the normal process, with Lord Case writing to the Prime Minister, please let us know who your choice is so we can vet, that was the process that he requested, and the Prime Minister chose to ignore it.
That wasn't the normal process, but the process was a bad process. But can I just say, Nick, just to be absolutely clear with you, Peter Mandelson should not have been appointed.
No.
This is a very damaging episode for the government. I know that Keir Starmer knows that, and lessons have to be learned about who gets appointed to top jobs and the processes that are followed, absolutely.
But surely Diane Abbott, your former colleague, nailed it when she said, why didn't he, the Prime Minister, ask about the vetting? Why this lack of curiosity?
To be fair, the Prime Minister was told that the proper processes had been followed. He wasn't told Peter Mandelson's. But I do want to say this, Nick. Keir Starmer has held his hands up. It's not true that he's simply blaming everybody else. It's just not true. He said, I made the decision on Mandelson. I was wrong. I fess up that it was the wrong decision.
You don't find this extraordinary lack of curiosity puzzling in a Prime Minister?
I think the Prime Minister was dealing with many, many things on his plate.
Of being a Prime Minister?
Yes. He got recommendations around this issue. He wasn't told that Peter Mandelson had failed to develop vetting. I mean, you heard his account
in the House. But the Independent broke it in September. Does he not read the papers?
But hang on a minute. Yes, and he asked last September.
Seven months ago, he was told that he'd failed, Mandelson had failed the security checks.
Hang on a minute. Just to go straight to that question. In September, Keir Starmer asked, after Mandelson was sacked, was the proper processes followed?
It's never his fault, is it? Poor man, he's only got the power of being the Prime Minister. It's not enough, is it?
But it's odd that you say that, Nick. But he says it is his fault that he appointed Peter Mandelson.
And he chose not to monitor how the vetting was going. And having broken by a newspaper in September, there's no one banging your desk saying, hang on, what's the Independent saying? Has he failed?
You see, I think that what you're saying is he made a mistake. And I think you're right, he made a mistake. He said that. He shouldn't have appointed Peter Mandelson.
But it's whether he knew, of course, in September, as anyone who chose to read that newspaper knew. And yet, again, it excited no curiosity in the man.
I don't know whether he read The Independent last... do you read The Independent every day? You probably do. No offence to The Independent. But I don't know whether he read The Independent. He's dealing with all kinds of issues, but he definitely asked last September whether the proper processes had been followed. Look, I think this goes to a bigger question, which is, do Prime Ministers make mistakes? Yes. Did he make the wrong judgment? Yes, he did. But you have to make a whole series of calls as Prime Minister. Sometimes, people are fallible.
Great. Unknown to you. Great to have you on. Thank you for your time. You're going to be speaking at the Good Growth Foundation's National Growth Debate, and you'll be setting out how global instability is exposing the costs here in the UK in the action you and your colleagues wish to take about it. Thank you for your time. You've got us to 1 minute after 8, LBC News headlines.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the former boss of the Foreign Office, who was sacked over the betting row surrounding Lord Mandelson, is due to give evidence to MPs this morning. Sir Ollie Robbins left his role after his department was accused of allowing the peer to bypass a failed security check. Keir Starmer insists he was kept in the dark over the vetting ahead of the peer being made US ambassador. Shadow Cabinet Minister Sir James Cleverly has spoken to LBC this morning and says he doesn't think Keir's defence is credible.
He basically said, look, we all knew that Mandelson was a high-risk appointment, but we all thought the risk was worth it. Now that that appointment has blown up so spectacularly, somehow they're trying to revisit their justification by saying, oh, nobody knew that Peter was a potential security risk. Today, we're going to see just how tissue paper thin that excuse really is.
The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, has just spoken to Nick. He was asked why Sir Keir Starmer didn't take more of a hands-on role over the vetting.
I think the Prime Minister was dealing with many, many things on his plate. He
well, isn't that the role of being a Prime Minister?
Yes. He got recommendations around this issue. He wasn't told that Peter Mandelson had failed the developed vetting.
Stay with LBC for the very latest. One of Iran's top negotiators has cast fresh doubts on whether a second round of talks with the United States will go ahead later. President Trump has insisted he's not under pressure to make a peace deal, but says one will be made relatively quickly. The ceasefire between the US and Iran is due to expire tomorrow. Teaching unions are backing plans to force schools in England to ban smartphones. The government's expected to give more details later today after announcing yesterday that it wanted to make it law, not guidance. Currently, headteachers can ignore the advice if they disagree. The UK's unemployment rate fell to 4.9% in the 3 months to February. The fall was unexpected, with many experts predicting that the rate would remain unchanged at 5.2%. And London Underground services are set to face significant disruption as the first of two strikes begins at midday. Members of the RMT union are walking out for 24 hours at lunchtime in a dispute over a move to a four-day working week. TfL says the changes would be voluntary. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading at 58 points, down from 10,609 yesterday. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather dry and sunny for large parts of the UK through to date. Some outbreaks of rain for the north of Scotland with a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Hans, the GC here. I'm whispering because,
as the Queen,
Queen of social media, it's about time for my ASGMR series.
So I'm recording this on my phone and then I'm going to use Canva to edit and upload it. Oh, sorry, babes. I'll make that a whisper when I edit it. Anyways, Canva makes social media edits so easy. I'll upload this in a minute. Canva, make everything iconic.
How do I stop recording, Darren?
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast.
Good morning, 5 minutes after eight, Tuesday the 21st of April, ringing the changes as regards mobile phones in schools. They will be banned, as or suggests the government. How exactly will they work? And more importantly, my children long since left school, they're having their own children, but how much impact does it actually have in the classroom? In other news, another tube strike on the way. We'll have a representative of one of the relevant unions, the RMT, but here's Editor-in-Chief of City AM, Christian May, talking about the impact it has on hospitality business in London.
People will work from home for the next few days, and it's London's pubs and restaurants in particular bracing for a knock of as much as 40% of their daily sales from this week.
The horrific findings, at least two school-aged children die each month from knife injuries in England. Most fatalities resulting from a single stab wound. Dr. Jade Lavelle is a senior lecturer in social and public policy at the University of Bristol and conducted this study.
At school, they were having difficulties, maybe engaging in violence, and often then they were met with exclusion and discipline.
And it's half-time in the Starmer Mandelson ding-dong we heard from the Prime Minister yesterday. Coming up in around an hour's time, perhaps a shade under, Sir Ollie Robbins, of course, the senior Whitehall Mandarin who lost his job. And as a curtain raiser, Energy Secretary Ed Miliband told us.
Do Prime Ministers make mistakes? Yes. Did he make the wrong judgment? Yes, he did. But, you have to make a whole series of calls as Prime Minister. Sometimes, people are fallible.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 60 60973. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
How much is your child, particularly if they're 12 or in their early teens or mid-teens, how much are they tied to their mobile phone? How important is it to you, and I appreciate I might be speaking to you as teenagers now, but to your mums and your dads, or possibly your uncles or grandparents, whatever it might be, that you can stay in contact with them? I've missed the bus. I forgot my hockey kit. Or in my case, I've got a detention. I'm afraid I won't be leaving school till 5 o'clock. Or whatever it might be. Imagine that being taken away from you. In some instances, I am told, it's a long time since I sat in a classroom, but in some instances, access to a mobile phone is required for the work that children do. So what of this idea that phone bans in England schools will be enforced by law in an advisory from the Department of Education? Now, this would appear to be another screeching U-turn. We'll just put politics to one side, just briefly we need to say, because it's the benefit of the children that matters the most, the pupils. But it does seem to be a U-turn. If we go back to Prime Minister's questions in March of last year, Sir Keir Starmer insisting banning smartphones was not necessary.
Why did Labour MPs vote against banning phones in schools last week?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Because it's completely unnecessary. I've got teenage children. Almost every school bans phones in school. They do it already. We need to concentrate on what's really important here, which is getting to the content that children shouldn't be accessing. That's where I would genuinely like to work across the House, because I think there's a huge amount of work to do. But the battle is not with schools that are already banning phones in school. The battle, and this is an important emerging battle, is to work together to ensure that we can ensure that the content that children are accessing, wherever they are, is suitable for their age.
Mr. Speaker, we can look at the content, but if the ban is unnecessary, then why is it that they've started a review? Just last week, his education secretary called a ban a bit gimmick, yet teachers and head teachers say the evidence already shows that schools that ban phones get better results. And he's wrong. Not all schools do this. Only 1 in 10 schools are smartphone free. So will he U-turn on this?
We need to ensure that all schools do this, but the vast majority do. It is really important that we focus on the battle we have to have with mobile phones, which is the content that children are able to access. And we need to ensure that that is controlled wherever they are. So it's a question of having the right battle on the right issue, not wasting time on something where almost all schools are already banning mobile phones.
Let's put the politics to one side and get into the benefits, the welfare of our children, and bring into the conversation David Lee Allen, who's Executive Director of the Suffolk Association of Secondary Head Teachers and was a former head teacher himself. Good to have you on. Thanks for coming on, Mr. Lee Allen. So the Prime Minister says we need to get to the content of what's on these phones. Let's get to the bottom of where head teachers find themselves. Would they be in support of this? Good morning to you.
Good morning. Yes. I think they will support it. I think the clarity of the of this decision, as opposed to the sort of halfway house that we had before, supports head teachers really. Certainly in Suffolk, I think 95% of the secondary schools that liaise with it within my organisation have already got bans of sorts in place. I had some fascinating conversations last night with some head teachers. Mm-hmm. From those that had a kind of on-site, out-of-sight ban, you know, an acknowledgement that the students had the phones, but they weren't allowed to see them, you know, and if they did come out, that they were supposedly, you know, confiscated during the day, whatever, through to those that have moved to this sort of pouch system. And that in itself was fascinating because...
If we want to get to the nuts and bolts of this, what is the pouch system? How does it work?
Yeah, well, there are variances in this, as in everything, but the most extreme versions of this are, they're like the little pouches that you can get to hide your car keys in.
Yeah.
So it blocks the signal. But what some of them have, and there's one school I was talking to, they have a system where outside of the school boundary or building, there are devices that lock the student's pouch. So the student owns the pouch themselves. Mm-hmm. They put the phone in. They're outside. A member of staff puts it through the system that then magnetically locks it, so they can't access it during the day. That sounds, you know, that sounds great. And what the head teacher in that particular school was saying was, what she realised, because she'd previously had an on-site, out-of-sight ban, what she realised was that how clever the kids had been, and that they were still using them. They were going to the toilets, they were still messaging. If something kicked off in the canteen, it was suddenly all around the school, and she was thinking, how do they all know? Do you know what I mean?
I remember those days.
Well, of course, social media and use of TikTok and things like that exacerbates those things. So what she has said is she said it's significantly calmed the school by that not being able to do that.
Obviously very welcome. Thanks for your input. David Lee Allen, your Executive Director of the Suffolk Association of Secondary Head Teachers. You're a former head teacher yourself. So that's the teacher side, the professional side. What about parenting? Daisy Greenwell is founder of Smartphone Free Childhood. Daisy, thank you for coming on. Can you give us any idea, and I appreciate there's no measure for this, but what sort of damage, how much does it affect a day's learning, the use of these phones in some instances? Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, yes. I mean, we hear from parents and teachers in our movement that phones in schools are having a hugely negative effect on the experience of the pupils' school day. You know, everything from just lack of focus, being on their phones in lessons, to bullying, TikTok's social media crazes, which are, you know, just affecting everyone's ability to mm-hmm. get on with the school day.
What age do you think is an appropriate age for a child, I would imagine, a teenager, to get his her mobile phone?
Well, what we recommend is that parents start off by getting a simple brick phone that calls and texts rather than one that goes on the internet and has social media.
And what sort of age is that? Could that be a Christmas or birthday gift?
Well, we'd say, you know, maybe when they start at the final years of primary school, when they mm-hmm. if they're walking to school alone, parents want to be able to keep in touch. So if you're going to do that, get a simple phone. And we say try not to get a smartphone till they're 14 and no social media till 16.
How will we know if this proposed ban or this advice is working? What should we look for?
I guess it will be what we hear from pupils and teachers. Are they finding that schools are actually now able to enforce bans and that schools are genuinely smartphone free? I think that part of the problem with this is that it still includes no see, no hear policies, the head we just had on was talking about, which we know are really hard to enforce. But I think what it will do is that it will give teachers a legal backing and empower them to feel more confident to bring in place smartphone free policies, which schools are doing all across the country. We've had thousands and thousands of schools going smartphone free over the last couple of years because parents in our community and parents all across the country are asking them to do so because they want stronger policies so that their kids can have a better experience at school.
Daisy Greenwell, your founder of Smartphone Free Childhood, thank you for your input on that. Calls coming in already, the importance of phones, your concerns, and of course I would imagine there could be it could kick off a little bit in reception or wherever the child is meant to hand over his or her phone. Coming up after the news, if you're in London, I'm afraid we're set for yet more tube strikes. And then the next hour, it's a busy hour, we're going to be hearing from Sir Ollie Robbins. He's, of course, in front of that panel of MPs. And also we go back in time to hear this message.
To you living in new surroundings, we send a message of true sympathy.
Queen Elizabeth II is a 14-year-old girl. Her first ever broadcast message, she was going to go on to give countless, you wouldn't even be able to count them, and that was during the Second World War. It's the anniversary of her birth, 100 years on. We'll look at that in the next hour. It's 8:15, LBC News headlines, Dominic Ellis.
A former head of the Foreign Office is preparing to publicly defend his actions before MPs over the Lord Mandelson vetting row. A study has found at least 2 school-aged children a month die from knife injuries in England. And President Trump insists he's not under pressure to make a peace deal with Iran, but says one will be made relatively quickly. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for northern Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. Delays on the M1 in both directions, at Junction 11 at Dunstable South. A lorry's broken down southbound, so 2 lanes are closed, and there's been an accident northbound, so 1 lane is closed. Huge delays continue on the Kent stretch of the M25, anti-clockwise to the Dartford Tunnel. It's slow from Junction 3 at the M20 because a lorry's broken down here as well. And a lorry was on fire earlier on the M4 eastbound, just before Junction 13 at Cheveley at the A34 exit. The exit slip road Road is also closed, so there are lengthy delays on the main carriageway. On the trains, LNER services are disrupted between King's Cross and Peterborough, and a reminder that the tube strike starts at midday.
LBC.
Oh, Fiona's back at the monkey safari again. She's hooked on Toyota Service and Aftercare. In fact, it's so good, she'll find any excuse to come back. From replacement wipers to service and MOTs, our perks include free refreshments, quiet workspaces, courtesy cars, and a new warranty with every eligible service. Toyota Service and Aftercare. So good, you'll find any excuse to come back. Eligible services are available until the vehicle turns 10 years old or 100,000 miles. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store.
McDonald's cards are here. 24 cards to find and free food in every pack. Enter cards in the McDonald's app and complete sets with over £4 million in cash prizes to be won. McDonald's cards. 18 plus UK only with selected meals subject to availability. Ends 27th of April. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Oh, you want weight loss advice?
Weight loss? Actually, what you want to do is...
I got my weight loss secret from my mother, who got it from her mother's
my tip
weight
is,
loss?
I... No, forget that. No, you
just keep dancing.
Dragon fruit.
Podcast.
I swear.
Advice.
Advice. Advice. Advice. Advice. Advice.
Or you could go to MedExpress. MedExpress. Healthcare without the noise. Go to medexpress.co.uk/weightloss.
Ali 60 milligram hard capsules contain orlistat for overweight adults with a BMI of 28 plus. Follow a reduced calorie, low fat diet. Always read the label.
Tonight's Euro Millions jackpot is £126 million.
I think that deserves a whoop whoop. Whoop whoop! Thank you, faraway person. Get in tonight's draw. Euro Millions from the National Lottery. It could be you.
Estimated jackpot. Rules apply. 18 plus.
Your time is valuable. Your perspective should be too. The Economist cuts through the noise with the stories that truly shape your world.
How can you believe that a new regime won't crush you just like the previous one?
Online scams are stranger than they've ever been.
When the world's turned upside down, know which way is up. Read, watch, or listen to The Economist.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973.
Right, come to your calls in a moment about this phone ban in schools. 19 minutes after 8, I realise I've not done anything like enough for social media texts that are coming in. Let's do some of those now. This comes in from Do Remember to Sign Them. You haven't done the first one, I hope you haven't, but G has. Ban them. The bans are being enforced effectively. It's hot. Oh, I think you mean it's hit and miss, depending on the school. I think it's hit and miss, you mean. The pouch doesn't always work. My school still lets you have them until lunchtime. Kathleen says, how many adults, parents and teachers go 1 hour without being on the phone? And one last one, this from Andy in Shrewsbury. I get the school bans and it's great, but we need to know how schools are still going to educate around them, as they will definitely be on them before they're on the school bus. Interesting, they'll be banned at school but not at home, so what's the difference? Kathy in Nottingham, are you a mum? If so, how old are your child or children? Is your child or your children? Good morning.
Morning, Nick. Hi, I'm Kathy. My daughter is 12, so right. She is just on the cusp of being able to use social media.
Yeah.
So... have managed to bat off the peer pressure. All her friends use social media, you know, they have
used... Does she have a phone, a brick phone or a smart... What sort of phone does she have?
Has a smartphone with very strict screen time.
Right.
My issue is at school, they have a no-see policy, right. Which is fine until the teachers then ask the children to get their phones out and take a picture.
Right.
Use it in such a way, which, because, you know, to take a picture of the homework or to take a picture for reference to do their DT homework.
Yeah.
So it's not, it has to be across the board, because there's me trying to say, do not get your phone out in school. If I see that you've been on anything because of the screen time, I can see, there will be consequences. But then she's been said that she can get it out and take a picture at school.
That's weird. Let me ask you, how important is it for you to know where your daughter is, to know she's okay, to know that the bus might be late or whatever, that she has a phone, Kathy?
Yes, she does. You know, as a mum in 2026, she has, apps that I can track her. We live in rural Nottinghamshire,
right.
And she takes a bus of quite some distance, you know, so I like to know where she is. And I think it's important in this day and age, you know, where, you know, things can happen. So I do like to. So I have got that dichotomy of wanting to know where she is, wanting her to have a phone because it gives me that peace of mind as a working mum. but then also this battle against screen time and the addiction of it. There are some children that can pick their phone up and put it down and not look at it for a few hours. But there are children like my daughter who just loves her phone, will happily do the endless scrolling, you know, and if she, and I just, you know, unless I put very, it's very strict screen time things on to maybe an hour a day of YouTube, then I would lose her entirely to it. I know that.
Lastly, she's on the cusp of being a teen. She's on the cusp of being a young woman. What concerns do you have as regards her phone, and how do you and your husband or your partner, whatever, how do you think you might try and monitor that, Kathy?
Well, I will maintain keeping abreast of technology and being able to put these strict screen times on. And also cross my fingers and cross my toes that a social media ban comes in for under 16, so then I don't have to worry about it until she's 16, because that has been a rule of our house that yes. I will not, you know, help her fake her date of birth so she can get social media early. You know, if her friends' parents are happy for them to do that, that's on them. But what I've been able to hang on to is that you are not allowed to do it, so we're not doing it.
Kathy, well done. Look after her. I can hear in your voice how clearly you intend to do it. Good luck with that, Kathy. Jen in Rugby. Jen, is this the right policy, do you think, or the right advice from the government? Morning.
Morning. I think so, yes. My daughter is 13. She is in year 8, and the pouches were brought in the summer term of last year.
Right.
Initially, she wasn't very pleased because she felt that she used it for socialising and lunch breaks and dinner breaks and what have you. But now she is much happier to give it up every day.
Why? Does she tell you why that is?
Yeah, she says that they talk more, they play card games, they socialise in person a lot more rather than just on their screens.
And what about her school work? Do you think that's improved in any way?
She's a good student anyway, but they don't tend to use it for school because they have access to their own laptops in school, so they can use that if they need any technology.
And just briefly, to listeners who are not familiar, because of course there will have to be some who don't have children or even grandchildren, how does the pouch work for your daughter?
So she puts her phone in it when she gets to school, before she gets into the school gates, and it's like a magnetic lock thing, I think.
Yes.
And then at the end of the day, she can, I think she holds it up to a sensor or something and it unlocks. But if they're found with their phones in school, they are taken away from them, I believe, for 24 hours. So it's quite a stringent punishment.
And that, for some teenagers, that would be almost like losing a limb, I would imagine. Jen, I'm glad to hear it's working for your daughter. Thank you. Look after. We'll have more calls on this in a moment. 8:25. Now, if you live in London, get ready. Unfortunately, for what seem to be more tube strikes, it's virtually unstoppable now, I would suggest, as they will be between Tuesday and Friday of this week. Team talks apparently seeming to break down. Let's get to one side of this. Jared Wood is London Transport Regional Organiser for the RMT, if I can. Mr. Wood, just ask you initially, just to give the details, when does the stoppage start? When does the stoppage stop? Morning to you.
Yeah, morning, Nick. So the stoppage starts today. Our drivers won't be booking on for any duties that start after midday until midday tomorrow, and then from Thursday to Friday on the same pattern.
What is the problem? Why are both sides at loggerheads, Mr. Wood?
Well, the problem is London Underground is imposing a whole package of changes to terms and conditions. That covers things like the length of time that a shift can cover. It covers the continuous driving time during a shift. It covers the amount of notice that a driver will get of their shift. They want to have a situation where some people wouldn't know until 24 hours before their duty what they would be working day after day. Covers things like transfer arrangements, when you can move, flexible working requests, all sorts of things that we've negotiated with them over decades and have now come along and said we're going to impose all of these changes. They will not negotiate with us. Their position of a year ago remains exactly their position of today. And we don't seem to be able to get them to have a serious discussion with us about this.
TfL managers are quoted saying these changes would be voluntary. Are they misleading us by saying that?
Well, I think that statement is misleading because we've been pressing them since these plans were first revealed in March last year to tell us what they mean by voluntary. And we've asked them some specific questions. We've said, does that mean that every driver who currently works the current arrangements can carry on doing that? Would new drivers coming into the role be able to do that? Would people on transfer be able to do that? And also, critically, when they say it's voluntary, do they mean that you can choose whether you work 4 or 5 days? Or do they mean that the whole package of changes to your working conditions are going to be voluntary? And they've given us no answer to any of those questions for a year. And we've set them out to them again in writing. And they've told us that the only way that we'll find out the answers to those questions is to help them implement it. And then we'll find out. Well, that's not a serious response.
Is it correct that you want a 32-hour week for your colleagues?
The union's policy is for a 32-hour, four-day week across the rail industry, and it's something that we've been pushing towards. You know, the reduction in working hours is something that the trade union movement has fought for since Victorian times, Nick. That is our stated policy position.
Well, I doubt you were doing a four-day week in Victorian times, your colleagues, do you?
No, that's my point. We've been fighting for reductions in working weeks since Victorian times.
But what are you
at
currently? What's your hourly?
Currently it's 35 hours over 5 days.
So you want to go to 30...
actually work a little bit more than that and bank a few hours.
So you want to go to a 32-hour week over 4 days, and I have a note here that train drivers on the London Underground earn around £72,000 a year, with experienced drivers more than £75,000 a year.
Yeah, I think you're talking about instructors rather than experience.
All right, well, let's stay with the driver. £72,000 a year for a 32-hour week. How many weeks a year?
Yeah, that's right.
How many weeks
a year? Let's be clear, Nick. You asked me if that was the policy of our union. It is. That is not what this dispute is about. We are not saying that the only way London Underground can resolve this dispute is to agree a 32-hour, four-day week. Of course, if they were to do that, it would resolve it. But we are prepared to sit down with them and talk about improving the position that they've put forward. It's not just about 4 or 5 days. It's a 14-page document that covers every aspect of a driver's working conditions. And we think that they're going to undermine safety and the working environment for our members on a day-to-day basis. And that has been imposed on us without any attempt to negotiate at all, and that's why we're in dispute.
But possibly by this time next year, the salaries will be in the region of £75,000 to £77,000 a year for a four-day, 32-hour week.
Not for a four-day, 32-hour week. Those salaries.
That's what you require. 32-hour.
Well, I think we've covered that, and I think people are clear on what I've said about it, Nick. This dispute is against the imposition of a whole number of changes to working conditions that would leave people not knowing what they were doing from one day to the next.
Do you not think many of the passengers
and working up to 5 hours 15 without a break at all on the front of the train?
Do you not think that many of the
listeners want to be on a train,
Mr. Wood?
Driven by someone who booked on at 3:45 in the morning and worked 5 hours 15 flat without a single break. I don't think your listeners want to be on that train.
Lastly, I think many of my listeners, if you'll allow me to speak on behalf of my listeners, are somewhat concerned that the great men and women who drive the tubes and get them safely to their destinations are earning north of £70,000 for a four-day week that could be 32 hours. I think that's what would puzzle them, Mr. Wood.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter how many times you say it, Nick. That's not what this dispute is insisting on. That's an aspiration, and I think it's reasonable.
Well, if it's an aspiration,
as a matter of fact, London Underground tube drivers have not had significant real terms pay increases over the recent past. The reason why the
you
salaries
earn more than
the
doctors,
look
Mr.
good
Wood.
Is because other salaries have been depressed in the economy.
You earn
that's
more than
problem
credit
here.
To your
the
union.
Not what
you
tube
earn more
drivers
than doctors.
Earn. The problem is what
no,
other people
you have
people
to engage
earn
in
it.
A conversation. You earn more than credit to your union, but you earn more than doctors.
And I completely support the doctors who are taking action to improve
but
their
I would
salary.
Suggest a resident doctor's had a bit more training than a tube driver.
And a tube driver is on that salary forever. There's no grade system to go through. They don't become consultants and earn more or whatever. But
I will leave it there. I've gone over time. Jared Wood, thank you. You're London Transport Regional Organiser for the RMT. Take your views on that, and we'll come back to the phones in the schools debate too. It's 8:31. Let's get those LBC News headlines. Dominic Ellis.
The Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, told Nick that Sir Keir Starmer isn't hiding behind others over the the Lord Mandelson vetting row. The former head of the Foreign Office will appear before MPs shortly to defend his actions after he was blamed for allowing the peer to bypass a failed security check. A study has found at least 2 school-aged children a month die from knife injuries in England. The findings have come from a report by the Bristol Medical School, which is the first national analysis of its kind. And President Trump insists he's not under pressure to make a peace deal with Iran, but says one will be made relatively quickly. Tehran says it has no plans for new talks, despite a ceasefire between the countries due to expire tomorrow. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Outbreaks of rain in northern Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
It's said she crashed the economy.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
She says she was brought down by the blob.
The fact is, I wasn't captain of the ship, because I wasn't running monetary policy.
As Keir Starmer fights with the civil service, does he have an unlikely friend in that battle? The former Prime Minister, Liz Truss, joins me live.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Experience electric performance like never before with Polestar Maidstone at Lipscomb. Discover bold Scandinavian design, cutting-edge technology, and a drive that's as powerful as it is refined. For a limited time, enjoy exceptional value with 0% finance across the Polestar 2, Polestar 3, and Polestar 4, and savings of up to £5,000. Visit lipscomb.co.uk to explore the range and book your test drive. Make the switch to electric with confidence at Polestar Maidstone at Lipscomb, and drive the future today. Offer ends 30th of June. No minimum deposit required. T's and C's apply.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quaterpillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pot Bears. And 4 giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park. Book now at notcatch.com.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas, and Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy while stocks last.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
8:34. Before we move on and indeed come to more calls about phones in school and tell you another story, I would suggest considering more troubling concerning our children. 2 children die each month from knife injuries. We're going to be speaking to one of the authors of that report. I need to reflect, a lot of you wanted to get involved following my conversation with Ed Miliband, and most of you, not supportive of what you heard. I'll just take a couple from the top before we move on. Dennis Mack in Chelmsford. I don't think the real issue is heat pumps versus drilling. The point is, if some have suggested there's a risk of Russian aggression in the next few years, who is going to defend us? Where are the weapons? Where are the soldiers? That's the core concern. Defence spending isn't a lifestyle choice. It's a necessity. Simon in Hertfordshire. No incentive or subsidies for me to buy solar panels or an EV car. Daddy-o, all my suppliers put prices up due to the increase in fuel, so we are paying for it, as the Chancellor is focusing on watching very carefully, but doing nothing. That was, of course, what Mr. Miliband assured us, that Chancellor Rachel Reeves is focused on this issue. But I think when I continually pushed him for what it actually means in real terms, I was probably speaking for many of you. Tim, you're going to talk to me about phones in schools, but let's come to a story I said of grave concern, which is the safety of children in our schools, or perhaps or particularly when they leave our schools, which is when they can become victims of crime. At least 2 school-aged children die each month from knife injuries in England, most fatalities resulting from a single stab wound, according to the first national analysis of its kind. The research, and you'll hear from someone involved in that, reveals a troubling rise in knife-related fatalities among children under 17, from 21 deaths in the year 2019 to 20, to 36 in the year 2023 to 2024. Dr. Jade Lavelle is Senior Lecturer in Social and Public Policy at the University of Bristol, co-author of this study, and there are a number of studies that are published today, but let's come to this one. Thanks very much for coming on. What do you see as the underlying causes for this increase in youth violence? Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. I think what struck me is that for most children in our study, the fatal experience of knife crime wasn't their first experience of violence. but we were failing to support them at those earliest points.
In what way failing?
So 58% of the children in this study experienced childhood domestic violence. And what we saw were barriers to support at every turn. And then when later the use of violence continued, again, systems were just failing to reach out to them.
What sort of systems should have done what?
Well, we see several issues. One is that we assess risk based on immediate harm, whether that's of the child causing harm or harm to their parents. We see high thresholds for support, which means children aren't being seen. And we see people who, at the point of disclosure, just don't really recognise the trouble that children are in and fail to offer following support.
Are there common denominators, the background of some of these children, whether it's a certain social class, whether it's a certain background? What other issues could be brought into play?
Well, we know that children who are boys were overrepresented. So 90% of these children that unfortunately died were boys, and black children were over 13 times more likely to
over 13. Did you say 1-3? 13 times?
Yes. Good Lord. Yes. And children from deprived backgrounds were overrepresented. But something to note is that 75% had social services involvement at some point before they died. So it really points to a system failure that we are not supporting these children adequately.
Was any research done? Has any research been done on the aspect of the black children in this report?
Well, that's all part of what we were looking at, trying to see how could we have helped them earlier. And I guess it's consistent with wider research that says that we often fail black boys for various reasons. But we need to be reaching these children much earlier. Unfortunately, with knife crime prevention, a lot of our interventions are late stage when it's too late to turn it around.
Now, some other research, which I think has been published at the same time as yours, is in the Emergency Medicine Journal. And it says the average age of children who die in knife attacks is 14. And youngsters living in the poorest areas of the nation are 7 times more likely to fall victim. Again, appreciating this is perhaps not the research you did, but some pointers as to why is the age coming down? What does that mean going forward?
Well, I think it's important for us to recognise that actually only half of these children were in the context that we might associate with sort of public space knife crime. Actually, there's a much broader picture. Some children were killed at home. Some children were killed by domestic violence perpetrators, and some were in random attacks. So we really need to broaden the way we look at knife crime fatalities, because it isn't just the sort of street-based stereotype that often our policies focus on.
Grateful for your time and your work. Thank you, Dr. Jade Lavelle. You're senior lecturer in social and public policy at the University of Bristol, and your co-author of the first of those two reports that we discussed. You may have views on that, but certainly want to talk about the ban of phones in schools. Smartphones will be banned in schools. The Department of Education previously resisting demands to impose this prohibition, saying instead it will provide guidance for heads. Tim's in Rotherham. Is this the right way forward? Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Nick. No, I'm in favour of banning the phones, actually. I think it takes the decision pressure off of the school as well by doing that.
Why? What makes you come to that opinion?
Well, I think that they're hugely disruptive. I think you made a really good point earlier on when you spoke to one of the listeners, when you asked how disruptive are they in school. Well, context switching is a huge problem, and you can lose up to 25% of your, I guess, 25 minutes, sorry, of productive time,
yep,
trying to get back into a deep level of concentration. So if one child picks up their phone, gets disrupted and gets distracted, that impacts others. That's a huge loss of productivity, a huge loss of concentration, which hampers their learning, quite frankly.
And do you have children or nieces or nephews that this is relevant for?
I do, yeah. I have 2 teenage girls.
How do you, small p, police their use of mobile phones, and how much of a concern is it to you as a dad?
It's a huge concern, Nick. It's challenging. I mean, their school has banned phones, and if you do take a phone into school, you have to put it in a box.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, for myself and my wife, you know, it's a constant battle of monitoring, moderation, and challenge as well. And what I would just add on that, which is an important point as well, is that, and one of your other listeners mentioned earlier, there are controls you can implement called screen time. However, they aren't effective as what people think as well. I implement screen time for my kids, and 5 times out of 10, it seems to stop all of the apps from being used apart from the social apps. And this is a known problem as well. And many, many parents, there's lots of forums out there that are kind of campaigning for the developers to take a look at this and to fix this issue.
How much of an aspect of peer pressure for your daughters?
I think that plays a big part. I think particularly when they're in school and their peers are talking about the latest trend or something they've seen on TikTok, they want to feel involved. They want to feel part of that. They want to contribute. So that's a huge part of it as well.
And lastly, do you think there could be points of conflict? I could imagine some children are almost, I don't want to use the word addicted, but they can't imagine life without having the phone in their bag or their satchel or their pocket.
I think it is borderline addiction. And I think I can see that with particularly my youngest daughter, my eldest, who's 16, 17. She's more controlled and measured and dips in and out of her phone, Nick. But my youngest one, who is 14 now, it does look like borderline addiction there. You know, when we try to take the phone off, we have a rule about having phones at certain times. And if she's in the middle of using her phone and her time's up when we take it off her, you know, it becomes a battle, really. And she desperately wants to get back to that phone, almost like an addiction.
Yeah, there is that, isn't there? Thank you for that. Tim, look after them. Louis, coming to you in just a moment. We talked about this, unfortunately, tube strike that takes place later today and another one later in the week. Someone, can I give your name? Yes, Simon says, I recently joined the rail industry as a signaller. Previously, I worked as a flight dispatcher and supervisor at an airport for 20 years. I saw how rail workers would regularly get pay rises, so set about moving into a different career. I now earn double my airport wage for a lot less stress. Doctors living in dreamland if they think they can get such a big raise in one go, and 28% rise last year. Their union is to blame for not fighting for a few percent each year. Robert in Stanford will hope TfL staff have to be some of the most entitled specimens. I'm a contractor in the industry. I know exactly what I'm talking about. Matt says this underground train driver is out of touch. Well, he probably is, but he's a negotiator. He's a union representative as well. He's out of touch with reality. It's laughable. Does he realise how many people work more than 5 hours without a break and work 40-plus hours a week while being paid half of what they are? To his point, I would say, I don't know if they're driving a tube train with hundreds, possibly 1,000 people on board, but it is 35-hour week currently for nudging £72,000, a four-day week. It's not bad, is it, if you can get it? Let's talk phones in schools with Louis in Guildford. Does this government move make sense to you? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I'd like to just share some ideas as a parent, as a secondary school teacher, as a university lecturer.
Ah, so you're a teacher, are you, sir?
I was teaching in secondary, now lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
The school in my local area has done a great job. They have banned phones completely, and the way they did it was they had a phased ban where from year 7, year 8 and 9, they first banned it, and now they wrote it all over the whole school.
So just a reminder, year 7 is when you're 11. It's the first year of big school, as it were. On you go, Louis. Yep.
Yes, correct. And behavior has improved tremendously. I mean, there were several times when, even during break, there was no way of controlling students or getting them back into the classroom because of a single story that everybody is now probably talking about and using their phones.
Oh, I see. So it swept effectively the whole school community.
Absolutely. And one of the terrible things for a teacher is low-level disturbance in classroom. You just need just one student in class to text or send a text message quietly, and before you know it, the whole class goes berserk. So it was a very good thing for the head teacher of my local area to start this, and behavior certainly improved. Now, the problem for me there is, in secondary, we're doing this, and as a lecturer now, it's literally almost impossible to teach one lecture without getting the students to use their phone to do something. So the question there for me is, banning it in primary and secondary, and then they get into university and it becomes more or less a tool for study, are they ready? However, I am fully for a complete ban in secondary schools, because I have seen the impact for my own children and for my own local school.
Lastly, as a former teacher, what about there could be levels of stress confrontation from a teacher trying to get a phone, particularly from someone perhaps in their late teens? mid to late teens.
You know, that is a nightmare a situation for a teacher. You don't want to actually even try to attempt to do this, because you just need that student who is literally going to make sure that he ridicules you, and then your whole day, and then your whole week. And conflict with parents is a huge one from such students as well. So it's a definite good thing to look at banning these things from school.
Louis, thanks for your perspective as, of course, a former teacher, I'm sorry, but as a parent as well. We'll take more calls on that. And coming up after the news, an attempt to crack down on what's called shoplifting or shop theft. Here's the Met Police Officer Daniel Pike giving LBC a demo of new technology.
I could follow this person on it to then see if he's then attended another store, which would then give me a notification to say that she's then hit somewhere else.
More from a senior officer from the Met after this. It's 8:47, LBC News headlines, read by Dominic Ellis.
The former boss of the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, will face questions from MPs shortly over the failed vetting process of Lord Mandelson. A study has found at least 2 school-aged children a month die from knife injuries in England. And President Trump says he's not under pressure to make a peace deal with Iran, despite a ceasefire deadline due to expire. LBC weather dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Rain for northern Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. So many problems on the motorways this morning. Firstly, on the M1, both ways, it's slow to Junction 11 at Dunstable South. And that's because a lorry's broken down southbound and northbound. There's been an accident and one lane is closed. At the Dartford Tunnel, there are delays on the M25 anti-clockwise all the way back past Junction 3 at the M20 and on the surrounding routes like the A2 slow from Gravesend and also the A13's very busy because of the traffic over the QE2 bridge, which is slow because of onlookers. The M4 still very slow going eastbound to Junction 34 at Cheverly, and that's because that lorry was on fire earlier and 2 lanes are closed. And on the trains, well, these problems for LNER services do continue. Their delay between King's Cross and Peterborough.
LBC. Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Call Nick Ferrari now. 0345 6060973. LBC.
3, 2, 1, 0% APR and all electric Mini Cooper. What was that, Luton? Handling is extraordinary. Centre of gravity so low. And it could be ours with a 15% deposit and 3-year term. Okay, Luton, reroute me to the nearest Mini retailer now.
Land a new all-electric Mini Cooper with 0% APR. Report to your Mini retailer today. Mini UK is a credit broker. Ordered and delivered by 30th of June. PCP finance with Mini Financial Services. Subject to status. 18 plus. T's and C's apply. Mini.co.uk/Cooper.
Your time is valuable. Your perspective should be too. The Economist cuts through the noise with the stories that truly shape your world.
How can you believe that a new regime won't crush you just like the previous one?
Online scams are stranger than they've ever been.
When the world's turned upside down, know which way is up. Read, watch or listen to The Economist.
Go all Irish to France with great low prices. With Irish Ferries, you can for less. Irish Ferries, see you travel differently. T's and C's apply.
Switching to Vodafone full fibre broadband is now as easy as pie. Ooh, freshly baked. It's a walk in the park. Hello, little fella. It's like taking candy from a baby. Come on, as if I'd do that. With One Touch Switch, it's easy. We sort everything out for you. We even contact your current provider. Plus, we'll help towards leaving fees. Switch today to full fibre broadband with Vodafone.
Up to £200 credit to cover leaving fees. More information and terms at vodafone.co.uk/broadband.
Here's a bright idea. Let Wix see how much you could save on your electricity bills. With Wix Solar, our team handles everything under the sun. From design to the perfect installation of your solar panels. We're proud as a peacock to be rated excellent on Trustpilot, so you can feel confident your solar installation is in safe hands. Book your free solar appointment today at wix.co.uk. Wix Solar, a name you can trust with service you can rely on.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345 6060973.
9 minutes before nine. Just to remind you, of course, it's the second half effective of the Mandelson saga just after 9 o'clock, and you will hear it here on LBC as Sir Ollie Robbins, the one-time Whitehall Mandarin, who, of course, was summarily fired effectively last week by Sir Keir Starmer. Well, he'll have his say in front of a panel of MPs, but let's come to another matter, something we discuss quite regularly, which is shop theft or shoplifting. You count the cases in their millions each year. You count the impact of business, and it's hundreds of millions of pounds worth of goods lost. And here in London, the Metropolitan Police are determined now to take a tough stance on it. And here with more details in the studio, good to have you here, Assistant Commissioner Matt Twist, Assistant Commissioner for Frontline Policing at the Met. Thanks for coming in, Assistant Commissioner. Good to see you again.
Good morning, Nick.
Good to have you. Okay, give us an idea. There's a pilot going on in Lewisham. What exactly is happening down there? And, of course, how successful is it being? How does it work?
So what we've got in Lewisham is we've started using an online platform where retailers can report the thefts to us direct. And what they can do is they make a report of the theft, they can upload the CCTV, and they can upload the statements, which means that we've got a really good chance of being able to successfully prosecute the suspects. Where we get CCTV, we can identify the suspect in about 80% of cases. But at the moment, and before this pilot, actually, we're only getting CCTV given to us in about 20% of reported cases. So it's a really big correlation. If we get the CCTV in the statement, and then the shop is, the managers are willing to let their staff go and give evidence at court, we've got a really good chance of bringing people to justice.
So what are you saying here? More stores should be looking at implementing more CCTVs? What's the message from that?
So I think there's a couple of things. I mean, for us, evidence is really important to prove the crime, isn't it? And the best evidence we can get is evidence of the actual offence through CCTV. And a lot of stores have it, but is it in the right place? Is it good enough quality? And then are they able to provide it? Because sometimes shop workers don't have access to it at the store at the time, or it gets lost, or it's difficult to download. But actually, one of the online platforms, and there are several that we're using, allows the shop to upload it directly to us. It allows the statements to be uploaded. What it means is we can then identify multiple offences. So a really good example recently when, and it's been in the news, it's been sort of Marks and Spencers have reported, concern about this, which I totally understand. But the M&S petrol station uploaded an incident. We were then able to link it to 23 other offences. We were then able to arrest and charge the person with 23 offences and get a criminal behaviour order, which means that, you know, we can put sort of controls over some of these offenders. Because as ever the case with a lot of crime, it's the minority of people that are committing the majority of offences.
You mentioned a Marks and Spencer's petrol outlet. Was that petrol that was stolen, or was it goods within the petrol
goods
station?
Goods within the station, yeah.
Because we have a problem over the theft of petrol, as you probably saw. That's now in its tens of millions of pounds, and of course it's being made worse by the Iranian conflict. Listen, Your men and women are fully stretched, we know that. How seriously are you taking petrol theft and diesel theft?
So I think we're taking all theft more seriously. We've got to. And I think it's fair to say 18 months, 2 years ago, this wasn't a high priority. But actually,
is that petrol theft or shop theft?
Both. And there's more that retailers of petrol can do to prevent theft, because actually they have control over whether they authorise people to fill up their car. They have control over whether they insist on prepayments or not. So,
would you urge retailers to go to a prepayment system?
I think if people are concerned about it, they need to think about what preventative measures they can take. I mean, it's not for me to direct retailers, but if individual places or locations are seeing higher theft of petrol, there are measures that they can take, and we see some of them do that.
How responsive are police forces? Not necessarily the Met, I go up and down the country, because we have heard petrol retailers say, look, I get video footage, someone puts in £100 worth of diesel or petrol, I report it to the police and they say, well, we can't actually prove intent here. That is an issue in the law, isn't it?
I might unintentionally
drive away, Assistant Commissioner.
Yeah, so that is possible, but that might prompt an investigation to determine whether that's the case. And of course,
Have you got time for blokes and women to start knocking on doors to find out whether Nick Ferrari intentionally drove off with £100 worth of diesel?
Well, this goes back to the retail crime, because I think it's possible that you might unintentionally drive off once, but if you've done it 10 or 15 times, then you might think there's a course of conduct and we might start to need to investigate that. But I think the key thing is, and I think the same is true for petrol, but also for the retail crime, because we know retailers are worried about their staff, we know people feel intimidated, is we need the CCTV, we need the staff to give us statements so we have the evidence. And then we need the staff to be given time by their employers to, if necessary, come to court.
And do you think on some occasions that's some of those criteria not being met?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we see cases where staff members aren't allowed time to go to court, or if they do go to court, they're not paid for that time. And the position is actually is the more likely the retailer is to support the prosecution and allow their staff to attend court, the less likely they're going to need to do it, because the people we're dealing with know their way around this system. If they think they're dealing with a retailer that's going to support the prosecution, then guess what? The suspects will plead guilty.
And there has been this often widely held belief that unless it's £250 worth of goods the police aren't interested, you can dispel that completely.
Yeah, that's complete nonsense. And we've
been aware of that urban myth,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, there have been different moments in time where people have said £200 or £250. Actually, there's a good example where we were dealing with a food retailer where we sort of were dealing staff. What started off with the theft of sort of a sausage roll ended up with sort of 60, 70, 80 offences, and we prosecute people for it because we know that it's, you know, we know that it's causing concern. And we know that...
So you'll go after someone, even if it's a sausage roll. If there's a pattern of crime, a sausage absolutely. Roll becomes a pack of sausages, becomes some steak or whatever.
Absolutely. All and right. And the important thing is that if we prosecute someone for one sausage roll or one very small amount, then we know the criminal justice system isn't going to sort of resolve it successfully. But if we get sort of numerous offences that we package up together, then we're getting some really good sentences.
Lastly, you've mentioned the need for stores and staff to do more. You're probably aware that a Waitrose employee was dismissed following an incident where he tried to stop a suspected shoplifter from stealing Easter eggs. It's been reported he's now been given a job at Iceland. We now have a man in Morrison's, a manager, sacked by the supermarket for tackling a shoplifter to the ground. How far should shop staff go, Assistant Commissioner?
So, look, the cases are a matter for the individual stores and the retailers. We don't want to see people losing their jobs for doing public-spirited things and acting as we would hope other members of the public would. Equally, I understand why retailers don't want their staff to put themselves at risk. So I think it's a fine balance.
But what is your advice? In this instance, by the way, in Walsall, it was a known shoplifter who was helping himself to bottles of Jack Daniels and walking off with a bag. He was tackled to the ground by someone who'd worked for nearly 30 years for Morrison's.
Yeah.
He's doing the right things, isn't he, the store manager?
So he's preventing crime. He's acting as a public-spirited sort of citizen. My advice, though, is call 999. Tell the police the crime is happening now. Tell them you know who it is, that they're a repeat offender.
This is West Midlands, by the way. It's not the... Are they going to turn out, Assistant Commissioner?
Well, we would prioritise that, yes.
And just lastly, when does this Lewisham pilot expand? When might the whole of London benefit from it?
Oh, we're trying to do it now. So it's just a case of sort of the more retailers we can get on online platforms to report this, the better. And we've seen some fantastic results already in terms of our positive outcomes going up in South East London. Our intent is to make it available to all of our boroughs so within the coming months.
Grateful for your time, Matt Twist, Assistant Commissioner for Frontline Policing at the Met. Good luck to you and the men and women who serve under you. Thank you for your time, Assistant Commissioner. Let's get some LBC News headlines, 8:59.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the former boss of the Foreign Office is due to face questions from MPs shortly over the failed vetting process of Lord Mandelson. Solly Robbins was sacked after his department was blamed for allowing him to bypass a failed security check. Sir Keir Starmer insists he was kept in the dark about the development, ahead of the peer being made US ambassador. The Energy Secretary Ed Miliband told Nick opposition claims that Sir Keir was recklessly negligent are simply not true.
He definitely asked last September whether the proper processes had been followed. Look, I think this goes to a bigger question, which is, in part, you know, do prime ministers make mistakes? Yes. Did he make the wrong judgment? Yes, he did. But, you know, you have to make a whole series of calls as prime minister. Sometimes, you know, people are fallible.
Stay with LBC for the latest. President Trump insists he's not under pressure to make a peace deal with Iran, but says one will be made relatively quickly. Tehran says it has no plans for new talks, despite a ceasefire between the countries due to expire tomorrow. A study has found at least 2 school-aged children a month die from knife injuries in England. The findings, published in a report by the Bristol Medical School, is the first national analysis of its kind. The co-author of the review, Dr. Jade Lavelles, told Nick that urgent family-centred action is required.
What struck me is that for most children in our study, the fatal experience of knife crime wasn't their first experience of violence. 58% of the children in this study experienced childhood domestic violence, and what we saw were barriers to support at every turn. And then when later the use of violence continued, again, systems were just failing.
The government says it aims to halve knife offences in the next decade. The UK's unemployment rate fell to 4.9% in the 3 months of February. The fall was unexpected, with many experts predicting that the rate would remain unchanged at 5.2%. And the King has released a message remembering his late mother, Queen Elizabeth II, on what would have been her 100th birthday. In the video, Charles suggested that his mother would have been troubled by some current events, but would have also looked for the positives. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 6% at £10,615. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for northern Scotland. A high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
If you want to save a few quid, British Gas have a way. You get half price Lecky and it's called Peak Save. On every Sunday, it's the smart thing to do if you're regular folk or furry and blue. 11 till 4, let the good times begin. You could charge up the car or take the dryer for a spin. Half price electricity, what joy that brings. With British Gas Peak Save, we're taking care of things. T's and C's apply, eligible tariff and smart meter required.
This is LBC. From Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call and WhatsApp message now. 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Morning to you, 2 minutes after nine, Tuesday, April the 21st, coming to us a little bit earlier because we're waiting for part two, effectively, of the latest instalment of the Mandelson saga. This is Sir Ollie Robbins appearing before this panel of MPs. We're just hearing that a letter has been sent by Sir Ollie to the committee, so we'll do a little bit more background on that, but it could, of course, lead to yet more revelations. More on that in a moment. And how do you follow such explosive, potentially explosive material? Well, there's only one way. It's in honour of a monarch. It's 100 years to the day since Queen Elizabeth II was born. We will chart that remarkable life of service, and give you some of the message that has been recorded by the King. These times would have troubled her, but she believed in a brighter dawn, as the King pays off to his beloved mama. Many people interpreting that these times would have troubled her. Yes, possibly we're talking about Ukraine, possibly we're talking about Iran, but are we actually talking about one of her own children, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, in association with Jeffrey Epstein and the crisis in which she undoubtedly plunged the royal family? And if you want to talk about crisis with the royal family, unfortunately you have to turn to one of her grandchildren as well, don't you? Prince Harry and the issues that maybe are having as he enjoys his life over in California. And the pressures, of course, with the royal family there. And I've not even mentioned the cancer diagnoses for Kate or for the King. So much there to reflect on when we get into the world of the royals. But let's come back to the political brief. As I say, it is predicted or expected that Sir Ollie Robbins will be in front of a panel of MPs. But see if we can get any more background. I'm reading on one of the news tapes there that a letter has been sent. Do we know anything more about that? Or are we going now? Natasha, sorry to interrupt. Let's go straight to the meeting now. Dame Emily Thornberry is the chair.
And his role in what happened next, and in recent days, what has happened in relation to leaks and so on. I think that it's very important that we hear from you. We heard from the Prime Minister yesterday, and thank you very much for appearing. I know it must be a very difficult time for you personally, and we are very grateful to you for coming in.
Thank you, Chair.
We're hoping that you're going to feel a bit freer to give fuller answers to us than you did on the last occasion you appeared in front of us on the 3rd of November, or in your letter of the 16th of September, when you clearly told us the truth, but you only told us part of the truth. And it's a little bit like, you know, saying I had to run to work today, but not saying that you were chased by a bear. It reminded me of when I was a criminal barrister, and the importance of the oath being that you had to tell the truth and the whole truth. We're not going to ask you to swear on the Bible or anything like that, but I think that it is important that we do get the whole truth today, and I don't intend to kind of dwell on previous issues apart from just to say that now. Because what I'd like to do is just to move on to where we are now and what the questions are. And I think what I'd like to do is perhaps ask you to walk us through what the situation was when you appeared in the Foreign Office as Permanent Undersecretary. What was the state of play? And in particular, what was the status of Peter Mandelson and what needed to happen next? And what did you need to do in order to ensure that happened?
Thank you, Chair. And I know this sounds formal and maybe even a bit unlikely, but thank you very much for the opportunity today to come and speak to you about these matters. As you say, it has been a difficult time, leavened slightly by it being my birthday yesterday.
Yes, all that.
So thank you for the opportunity to set things out. I won't go on at length, but I think there are three important framing points I need to make. Firstly, as you say, when I walked into post as Permanent Undersecretary on the 20th of January last year, I wasn't walking into a vacuum. I arrived to a situation in which a due diligence report had been undertaken into Mandelson by the Cabinet Office, assessing the reputational risks and his fitness for office. The Prime Minister had then presumably taken advice on his fitness for office. The name had been submitted to the King as Minister's recommendation. The Prime Minister had made an announcement that Mandelson was his nominee without caveats. The British government had sought agrément, the formal diplomatic process for a host government accepting a nominee from the US government, and that had been obtained before I arrived in post. He'd been given access to the building. He'd been given access to low classification IT. And from time to time, for case-specific issues, he was being given access to higher classification briefing. So I'm afraid I walked into a situation in which there was already a very, very strong expectation, and you will have seen the papers released already under the humble address, that coming from Number 10, that he needed to be in post and in America as quickly as humanly possible. The very first formal communication of this to my predecessor from Number 10 Private Office being that they wanted all this done at pace and Mandelson in post before inauguration. So that's the situation I faced.
I'm sorry, so there is paperwork about that, and that can presumably will be disclosed to Parliament?
It already has been, Chair. That letter from Number 10 Private Office is already in the disclosures made. There's nothing improper about it, but that's the context I walked into. So I'm afraid what that translated into for my team in the Foreign Office, and certainly the handover briefing I was getting as I arrived at post, was what I felt was a generally dismissive attitude to his vetting clearance. The focus was on getting Mandelson out to Washington quickly. Despite this atmosphere, an atmosphere of pressure, the department completed developed vetting to the normal high standard. Because the vetting process is not there to determine fitness for office or reputational risk, it's there to protect national security. And the Prime Minister has already made those judgments.
I'm so sorry to cut across you. We will get on to that, but can I just... I still want to just take it in stages if it's all right with you.
Yes.
Because what I'd like to do is to ask you about... We hear about the circumstances, the announcement, the press release, the King having agreed, the Americans having agreed, the letter to him, congratulating him on it, the access. Mm. But it was all subject to vetting. And the question I want to ask is, what kind of pressure additional to that were you put under in relation to the vetting?
Thank you, Chair. And before I answer your question, which I promise I will, it was not a... I'm afraid I don't think at the point of his appointment and 4 days thereafter, it was actually a given that he would be vetted. Again, if you look at the documents submitted under the humble address, there is no stipulation from Number 10 that he should be vetted. The welcome that was sent to him immediately afterwards doesn't say, welcome to the Foreign Office, subject to vetting. The announcement put out on the 20th of December says that he will be out early in the new year. It does not say subject to vetting.
The contract does, though. The contract of employment.
The contract issued to him after he was vetted says that he must maintain his clearance. So did mine.
Okay.
That is an absolutely standard stipulation. But nothing about his appointment actually, as far as I've seen in writing, stipulates it. Yeah. There was then a debate between Cabinet Office, FCDO, about how to make sure that he is sent out to post with the appropriate clearance. And that took several days. A position taken from the Cabinet Office was that there was no need to vet Mandelson. He was a member of the House of Lords. He was a Privy Councillor. The risks that attending his appointment were well known and had been made clear to the Prime Minister before appointment. Now, in the end, the FCDO insisted and put its foot down. I understand my predecessor had to be very firm in person. But that was a live debate at the point of announcement, and I think it's important to make that clear to the committee.
And that, again, should be minuted. Those discussions should have been minuted, and it should be they should be part of the humble address disclosure.
Well, given your absolutely understandable focus on scrupulous accuracy, that's before my time, but I'm sure there will be papers.
Yeah. And who was the debate between? Who in the Cabinet Office? Do you know?
I don't know for sure. The briefing I had on arrival was that there had been a position taken from the Cabinet Office that, as I say, some of Mandelson's status meant that vetting might be unnecessary, and that had been a discussion for several days after the press notice. It had been resolved before Christmas and resolved in the FCDO's favour. And I only mention it, Chair, because I think to say now that it was always clear that his appointment was subject to vetting is something that the committee should consider, whether that's something they need to take more evidence on.
So before we move on, then, you're not sure who it was in the Cabinet Office, but can I ask this? Was it a politician or was it civil servant?
I don't know. I was not in post at the time. All I understand is that there was a live debate, I think at official level, but I couldn't swear to
it. Okay. So, additional to that, was there other pressure put on you or put on the Foreign Office?
I think throughout January, honestly, my office, the Foreign Secretary's office, were under constant pressure. There was an atmosphere of constant chasing. When will this
daily phone calls?
I couldn't say for certain daily, but I mean certainly very frequent from private office to private office. Has this been delivered yet? Never any interest, as far as I recall, in whether, but only an interest in when.
So when you say private office to private office, you're saying private office of number 10?
Yes, I am.
And who are we talking about there, then? Are we talking about Elsa Tarry?
I'm not going to say, Chair. I may no longer be a civil servant, but I didn't come here today to scapegoat other civil servants. I came here to make sure the committee understood the circumstances.
No, I understand that. I understand that, but I also want to know who the source of this is. And I want to be able to get as much evidence as possible to be able to identify who the source of the pressure was. I mean, from what you know, let's see if I can ask you this way. From what you know, what was the source of the pressure?
Well, I've said I think that the vector I was most conscious of was from number 10 private office.
And the number 10 private office is not sort of is a means by which others ensure that things happen. So behind the number 10 private office, who are we talking about putting pressure on the Foreign Office via the private office?
Thank you for asking it that way, Chair, because that's the reason I do not want to name other officials in number 10. I think that the private office would only have been feeling this pressure themselves if they were under pressure.
Yes. Did you answer the question?
I don't know.
So we do know that Morgan McSweeney was a protege of Peter Mandelson's, and we know that he was very keen on Peter Mandelson getting the job, and we know that he resigned, saying that it was all his fault and that he had advised the Prime Minister to appoint Peter Mandelson and took it on the chin, took the blame. So was it him?
I'm afraid when I said I don't know, I meant it. I don't know.
Right.
I told the committee what I do know, which is that the Foreign Office was being chased very frequently, and I don't hold the private secretary as responsible for that.
And was there any direct communication between anyone in Number 10 and you?
No.
So there was no one ringing you on your mobile phone or WhatsApping you or sending you any messages?
No.
And your phone is presumably something which has been handed in as part of the humble address and will be able to be investigated?
Certainly will.
I'm just told that once someone has finished being a civil servant, that their phones are wiped and that they're reused. So could you just give us an undertaking to make sure that doesn't happen?
My phone for the relevant period was downloaded before I left government.
Very good. Very good. OK. So it's private office to private office, nobody contacting you directly. But again, as far as you're aware, a record was taken of the contact between private office and private office.
I'm sure there are records of interactions between us. I couldn't swear to what those are or how many of them there are, but you'll have to ask the government that, I'm afraid.
No, but if it's a private office, it's your private office. And so Number 10 is contacting your private office, and your officials are telling you, we've had another phone call, we've had... What other way were you getting pressure?
I'm talking, Chair, remember, I'm talking about the whole of January here.
Yes.
The first 3 weeks of which I was not in post.
But were you actually in the Foreign Office, even though you weren't in post?
I had a handover week the week before I took up the position.
Right.
Where Philip told me a bit about the job, and I sat in a room some distance from his and read a lot of papers.
Did he tell you that you were going to get a lot of pressure?
He described to me the steps and the atmosphere that I've described to you.
Yes. Okay. So during the 2 weeks in January that your office is getting pressure, we've heard about phone calls. What else is there? Are there emails as well?
I don't think so. And this is I think the natural thing in many ways. Which is that a private secretary wanting to know what's going on, feeling under pressure themselves to deliver, is ringing up and saying, where are we on this? Can we make it happen? Can you deliver? Get on with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's right, isn't it, that there should be official records kept accurately and information should be handled as openly as possible within the legal framework, according to the code. So there should be a record of all the phone calls that are made.
I think if the modern civil servant made a record of every phone call that they received, they would do nothing else, Chair. So I doubt there's a record of every phone call. I'm sure there is a trail that explains that there was a regular contact.
I thought that genuinely civil servants couldn't buy a cup of coffee without making a record of it.
I don't seem to be able to buy a coffee without someone following me down the road, Chair, so...
Yeah, it'll pass. But seriously, it is part of the code, isn't it, to keep accurate official records and handle information as openly as possible within the legal framework. It's a really important part of this to keep records. And I hear what you say, not every phone call, but phone calls from Number 10 saying, get on with it, we want to appoint Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the United States, is an important phone call, even if it does happen every day.
It is, but if it's not telling the department anything new, then there might be no need to record it each time that you receive it.
The need to record it is to show the extent of pressure that the Foreign Office is being put under by Number 10.
Well, as I say, I think that when you take evidence from the government, they will be able to describe that period to you, and I've tried to do my best to do so when I was only in post for 1 week of January.
Okay. Can I ask you this? So let's move on to the 28th of January when UKSB recommended that developed vetting be denied, and that Peter Mandelson, they identified, was he was a man of high concern. You recognise those two phrases as being applied to Peter Mandelson?
I don't actually, Chair, but we can come on to that in a second.
Okay. Well, we understand that those two things were what UKSB concluded about Peter Mandelson. Now, Any questions I ask you about this now are not to be interpreted as questions about what is the content of that vetting. Right? I don't want to hear about what was in it. I want to know what happened as a result. But what I want to ask you is, you had a meeting with the Director of Security, Ian Collard, and I understand that you're saying that he presented you with the findings. You didn't actually read them yourself.
That's correct, Chair. Perhaps I could describe this meeting to you if that would help.
And again, is there a note of it?
There is a note of the decision. The meeting itself, of course, involved the team describing to me some of the issues and the way in which they proposed to manage them. It wouldn't have been appropriate to record that in detail. The decision of what we agreed we would do and the ways in which we would manage it is recorded and is available in the Foreign Office.
And that record is part of, if I can call it, a DV bundle. So there's the UKSV paperwork, and then there's paperwork from the Foreign Office. And so those two, there's a part one and part two. And so it's part of that bundle, but it isn't, the record that you're talking about is not a freestanding document.
I think I know what you're driving at, but may I describe this in my own words, Chair? There has been a good deal of misunderstanding about this process, if I may say so. For the Foreign Office and for several other departments, UKSV does not fail a candidate.
Nor does that.
The department... No, I know, and apologies, Chair, but others have. And nor does the Foreign Office overrule UKSV. The relationship between the two is set out in guidance and has been set out to this committee and in Parliament. And so the outcome of the vetting process is what is decided by the Foreign Office on the basis of the UKSV findings and our own assessment of the risk and whether we can manage them. And so what the meeting I had with the director on the 29th of January, it was an oral briefing. No documents were presented to me, nor did I particularly expect them to be. I have never seen a UKSV document. I was briefed that UKSV considered Mandelson a borderline case and that they were leaning towards recommending that clearance be denied, but that the Foreign Office's Security Department assessed that the risks identified as of highest concern by UKSV could be managed and or mitigated. I was also told that the risks did not relate to Mandelson's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, and that I was told that UKSV acknowledged, I don't know in what way, but acknowledged that the Foreign Office might wish to grant clearance with appropriate risk management. So we talked about what that appropriate risk management might be, and the grant of clearance, the record of that decision, internal, records the grant of clearance and also the mitigations.
I don't really follow why you wouldn't know the contents of the UKSV and their concerns, or even that they had said that there was high concern about Peter Mandelson. I don't understand how you could not know that if you are considering what the mitigations are. You can't have the mitigations without knowing what the problem is.
The risks were explained to me, but I have not seen the underlying documentation. That's what I'm saying, Chair. That obviously strikes members of the committee as odd, but...
Well, yes.
In all my years as a civil servant, many of them as a relatively senior one, I have never seen a UKSV document, other than the ones I filled in myself. And that doesn't surprise me. The government makes very clear in public guidance that for anybody to be briefed outside the vetting security process, for anybody to be briefed on the information into or findings of a UKSV process has to be for, I think I quote, wholly exceptional circumstances.
And this is a wholly exceptional circumstance, surely?
No. What I was told was absolutely within normal parameters of a set of findings from UKSV and the department assessing those. They were issues that the department felt it had long experience and deep capability of assessing and coming up with a plan for how those could be managed and clearance granted. That is not unusual in this process, Chair. It was unusual, I admit, that I was briefed on it. I wasn't surprised to be briefed on it given the prominence and the profile of the case, but the underlying interaction between UKSV and the Foreign Office and the decision-making process was entirely standard.
When you were given your oral briefing, you claim that you were given the impression that Peter Mandelson was a borderline case and not a case of high concern, or one that was whereby the UKSV was recommending denial of vetting.
That's correct. I was told, let me be completely precise, I was told, I think, that UKSV were leaning towards recommending against, but accepted it was a borderline case.
Okay.
And I think it's important to say this, when we're dealing with documents and releases of documents, inevitably things look quite black and white. My understanding is, you know, the personnel security team in the Foreign Office and the vetting team in UKSV are interacting about literally hundreds of DV cases a day. We are a DV by default department, as you know, Chair. That means we have thousands of people who hold DV in the Foreign Office, many of whom are renewing their DV, new people arriving requiring DV. We are one of the biggest customers for DV services.
And I hear you, I understand this, but this really was exceptional. I mean, there isn't any other DV case where you were getting daily phone calls from number 10. I mean, this was different. You were being put under pressure. And I just find it, if you don't mind me saying, remarkable that you got completely a different view of what UKSV were saying about this than that which I understand is written down.
Well, I respectfully, I disagree, Chair. The department's security team are extremely professional, experienced people. They have a live dialogue with UKSV. The risks that were identified were ones that they felt they understood well and could manage.
Okay. Was there anything in the DV that was not already in the public realm? Was there anything that had been identified that we didn't already know, all of us?
As I wrote to you this morning, Chair, and I'm sorry if this begins to come back to your opening remarks, but I may no longer be an official, but I don't think I can open that box. This system.
Let's come away from the evidence being given there, as Sir Ollie Robbins cites that letter, which slightly misfooted us just at the start of that, because it was announced that the letter had been sent. It's dated today. LBC's political editor Natasha Clark is in the studio with me. We'll go over what we've just heard in a moment, Natasha, but I think you've had sight of this letter now. I've got one in front of me. Briefly, what is that letter? It's laying out effectively the background of where they're going to go today, isn't it?
Yes, Nick. It's basically laying out where we are ahead of this crucial evidence session. You've just been hearing from Sir Ollie Robbins speaking to Dame Emily Thornbury. She's the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, and it's just a letter from Sir Ollie basically laying out where we were. The first bit, just to note, at the very top of that letter, it says, I received a letter yesterday talking about dismissing me from employment. I've sought advice on that letter. Well, that's a red flag for me there. It sounds like he may be potentially thinking about taking some form of action against the government on behalf of his dismissal from the government. So that is one to watch as well. He also talks about, I asked the committee to respect my conviction that the integrity and confidentiality of this vetting system must be maintained. And you heard just there from Emily Thornbury, she's not actually asking about what's in that vetting. That's obviously very important for him and for all other ministers, that we don't actually know the details of this vetting. He did say, however, it's not related to Jeffrey Epstein and the former yes. peer's relationship with him. So that's an interesting point that we didn't know before.
At first sight of this two-page A4 letter, one senses it's been written by lawyers. The language gets a little more every day in what we've just heard. He talked about a generally dismissive attitude towards vetting. He talked about focus on getting him, Mandelson, out to Washington as quickly as possible. It was talked about the fact that there was no stipulation that he should be vetted, nor subject to vetting. There's a couple of real potential landmines in some of this, aren't there?
Yeah, and I think that what you just said there about the Cabinet Office, it's a huge bombshell, really, that he's just dropped there. To say that there were people in the Cabinet Office and number 10 that essentially were saying, do we really need to vet Lord Mandelson? He's already a peer, he's already a member of the House of Lords, he's already served in government. Do we really need to do this again?
So, and King's approval, without letter of congratulation, without exactly. any subject to stipulation.
I know, and that's actually something that I hadn't picked up on reading those Mandelson documents originally. It does say repeatedly in the emails that went to Lord Mandelson saying, we need you to submit this vetting. And that was something that Sir Philip Barton, who's the guy that was in charge before Ollie Robbins, repeatedly had to have that fight with the Cabinet Office, with number 10, before he even was even agreed to be vetted. And also just another thing to pick up, the constant pressure was how Ollie Robbins described it. He He said there was constant chasing. He didn't sort of specify exactly how that that sort of came. But the impression that we get is that he was being rung, that his private office was getting emails regularly, yes. and that they wanted Mr. Mandelson to be in place before the inauguration. Just a reminder, that was on the 20th of January 2025. But it wasn't until the 28th of January that UK security vetting denied him that clearance.
An atmosphere of, quotes, very, an atmosphere of very constant changing, very frequent. I've been asked, has this been delivered? Never any doubt into whether, but when. And this was something Dame Emily Thornberry, just to remind the listeners, that was the other voice you heard, the sort of Labour grandee who chairs that committee. She was very interested in the contact between the two private offices. What's she trying to get to there, Natasha?
She's trying to get to who was the person that was actually pressuring Sir Ollie to make the decision in the Foreign Office to make this decision. And obviously he decided to say today that he doesn't want to be the one to essentially throw other civil servants under the bus, like he clearly feels that he's done. You could hear the frustration in his voice. He's trying to make jokes about it, saying it's my birthday yesterday. Mm. It wasn't a particularly good one. And he's been chased down the road every time he tries to go for a coffee. And clearly there is a lot of pressure on him. But you're right. And he does lay out in this letter the situation that he found himself in. And let's again remind the listeners, he was appointed on the 8th of January, just a few weeks before Lord Mandelson was due to take up this appointment. And he says he was now under constant pressure as soon as he got in the job. Where is this vetting? Why is this not being done? So a lot of pressure there. He also wanted just to clarify the final thing. UK security vetting did not, quote, fail Lord Mandelson, and FCCDO did not overrule their decision. He says there's been a lot of misreporting about this. So essentially, he says that it was a borderline case, that he said he thought that the UK security vetting was leaning towards recommending him against. He said he actually hadn't seen the paperwork at all, which is quite an astonishing revelation.
You better go and listen to the rest of it, and we'll hear from you later in this hour. We'll come back to you. Natasha Clark, LBC's Politico. Thank you for that. We'll come back to our conversation marking extraordinary, the birthday of an extraordinary monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, born 100 years ago, and a very poignant message from her son, the King. It's 9:31, breakfast with me, Nick Ferraro, on LBC News Time. Then Ollie Robbins, that'd be something. Dominic Ellis.
The former boss of the Foreign Office has accused Downing Street of taking a dismissive approach to the vetting of Lord Mandelson. So Ollie Robbins has told MPs this morning there was an atmosphere of constant chasing and a focus on getting the peer out to Washington quickly. A teenage boy has been charged in connection with an arson attack on a synagogue in North London on Saturday. The Met Police say a 17-year-old who can't be named for legal reasons and who's a British national from Brent has been charged with arson. And Iran's chief negotiator has cast fresh doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the US will go ahead in Pakistan later. Mohammed Bagheer Ghalibaf says Tehran won't accept negotiations under the shadow of threats from America. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Outbreaks of rain for the north of Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC.
3, 2, 1, 0% APR on an all-electric Mini Cooper. What was that, Luton? Handling is extraordinary. Centre of gravity so low. And it could be ours with a 15% deposit and 3-year term. OK, Luton, reroute me to the nearest Mini retailer now.
Land a new all-electric Mini Cooper with 0% APR. Report to your Mini retailer today. Mini UK is a credit broker. Ordered and delivered by 30th of June. PCP finance with Mini Financial Services. Subject to status. 18 plus T's and C's apply. Mini.co.uk/Cooper.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for and when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Call 0345-6060-973.
Right, let's tell you what's going on. Dame Emily Thornberry is still leading that panel of MPs. In fact, she is still asking the question, so we probably won't go back to it yet because I've got a sort of text script running and it's going mostly over old ground. So If we just bring you up to date, as I've just discussed with my colleague Natasha Clark, this letter went in just minutes before, well, we were made aware of it, we should say just minutes before Sir Ollie Robbins stepped up and started giving evidence, and it talks a lot about the whole process, and you'll hear such as DV and NSV, national security vetting, DV developed vetting, on and on it goes. But what ultimately we have is the atmosphere that he described that he walked into, that it was an atmosphere that was translated into a generally dismissive attitude towards vetting, a focus on getting him, Mandelson, out to Washington as quickly as possible, which clearly speaks to the fact that, and then when you go into more detail, that the appointment had been announced, the Kings had effectively given his approval, or his, approval by the King, and all of that, nowhere was there any subject to vetting. Now, as was pointed out, the subsequent contract that he physically received, i.e. he has to sign before he starts his period of employment, did talk about vetting. But the appointment made by the Prime Minister, no subject to vetting. And then one could argue the King possibly led down that path, again, not told that there would be any vetting. Indeed, the clear implication comes across from Sir Ollie Robbins that they didn't really want any vetting. I take you back to what he said. And this is directly, no stipulation that he should be vetted. His words directly, not subject to vetting. Get him out and out in the early new year, is exactly what he said. Now, we'll come to your responses on that. It obviously feeds up from what we heard, as I said on a number of occasions, this is effectively the second half of this latest scandal involving him, with what we saw with Sir Keir Starmer. And it's interesting that Dame Emily Thornberry, who was, from memory, was the first person who responded, after Kemi Badenoch, who was the first Labour person to respond to the Prime Minister yesterday, is, of course, chairing this key committee today. And there does seem to be, and she was fairly frosty in her comments towards the Prime Minister. And this again speaks to the whole idea of even going for Peter Mandelson in the first place. I don't need to remind you, of course, that this was a person who resigned not once, but twice in unfortunate circumstances from previous administrations. And it could be said that he had a part to play in the downfall of one of his bosses, Tony Blair, and another of his bosses, Gordon Brown. Is he now playing his part? Has he got a threesome? Is he now playing his part in a trio? A third Labour Prime Minister in the shape of Sir Keir Starmer. So let's go back to what you were saying about that initially regarding the we saw from Sir Keir Starmer in the House yesterday. Simon Northampton, when you have Diane Abbott able to point out the flaws in your actions and able to school you, being quoted as stating the obvious, then clearly your credibility in the eyes of the public is shot and you need to go. This comes in from Mick in Tyneside. Isn't the truth of the matter this? This government have imposed on the British public high tax rises without failing to deal with the cost of living crisis. The Labour government, Starmer, are finished. They haven't delivered. It's as simple as that. Same subject. Martin says, Starmer shows exactly how much he is complicit in this government being completely non-governing. We have spent weeks discussing his disgraceful decision to appoint Mandelson when all he had to do was ask the question. All the time this is going on, we're sitting back. Red Ed Miliband, Rachel Reeves are continuing to drag the life out of our economy, all the while telling us there's nothing to see here, and more taxes quietly getting embedded into our lives, and the benefits brigade getting ready for a lovely summer. It's an utter joke. I've changed a couple of your words there. And Spencer in Crawley, the UK security vetting is the Cabinet Office, which is adjacent to 10 Downing Street. They're taking us for fools if they expect us to believe that no one in Number 10 found out that Mount Mandelson had failed his vetting, particularly with the close proximity. And that, again, is a point that Emily Thornberry is trying to get at. So when you heard that fairly chunky testimony about the exchange of messages between the private secretary, why was that so key? Or the private office, I'm sorry, the private office. Because that is where Emily Thornberry is trying to get, I would suggest, to talk about the direct involvement of the Prime Minister. Although we will probably hear that the Prime Minister, of course, didn't know that his own private office was making any phone calls, and yet another person will be blamed. You have to think that there's a degree of nervousness from Sir Keir Starmer and his team watching. Matthew's in Dundee. Matthew, what do you take from so far? Good morning.
Morning, Nick. How are you?
Good, thank you. Intrigued by this one. Are you?
Yeah, the whole thing's leaving a pretty sour taste in my mouth, Nick. Ollie Robbins seems to me to be a really, really genuine, decent civil service. He's thrown under the bus, isn't he?
He's a detail guy, from what you hear, isn't he? He's got his details, yeah. Certainly.
Yeah, I mean, like, everything he's saying doesn't indicate to me why is he the fall guy? I can't work out why is he being singled out as a fall guy and what seems to be something that he's inherited very late on. There was clearly pressure to get Mandelson elected from number 10, which is what the tail end of.
It's a very good question. I mean, I can only put my interpretation, and I think, why is he the fool guy? Because he's the easy one to go for, because he's the one that would seem to stop the rot getting even further. And the next place, of course, would appear to be, if we take from what he said about half an hour or so ago, would be the private office of number 10. Well, now you are quite literally knocking on the door of the Prime Minister's office.
100%. In this case, Nick, you are spot on.
Yeah, we all know what's gone on. The Prime Minister was determined to put someone who had a very shady past in a key post, and he didn't want to hear any criticism. He didn't want to, he'd hoped there would be no vetting, and when the vetting was going against him, he made no inquiries as to find out what was going on.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, pretty much that's it, isn't it? I mean, it's sometimes life is as simple as that, isn't it?
It is.
And that, I think, is what we are looking at in this case. And I just feel sorry for Ollie Robbins. I just do. That's really all I wanted to say.
Agree. I'm going to stop there. I want to go back in because we've now had a change of place now. Sir John Whittingdale, the Conservative. So this is the first Conservative questioning of Ollie Robbins. Let's see where Sir John Whittingdale takes us.
Been revoked after Agrément had already been obtained. Would that have damaged our relations with the United States, in your view?
I think it certainly would have had... Yeah, I mean, I think it would have damaged them, yes, Sir John. I mean, the process of getting Agrément was taken at quite some pace and was delivered, I think, still technically just by one working day by the Biden administration. I think if the nomination had changed after that point, the incoming administration may well have commented on it publicly, and it would, yes, have caused quite an issue in the relationship.
Right. And the dismissive approach of number 10... which you describe in your letter, you say that came from the fact that all of these steps had already been taken. Was there anything further which indicated to you that number 10 really didn't regard this as anything more than a formality which had to be completed?
To stay scrupulous, Sir John, nothing I can bear personal witness to, but certainly in my transition into the job, I was briefed, obviously, about the debate there had been about whether to vet at all, and that all added to a picture.
Thank you. Can I also ask you a little bit more about the meeting you had on the 29th of January, which resulted in the decision to give DV clearance? You've said that you were briefed about the contents of the report by UKSV, but you didn't see it. Now, we understand, indeed, the government has published the template decision-making form in which there are three boxes at the end, a green one, an amber one, which says approved but remain valid concerns, and the red one, the final one, clearance denied or withdrawn. Now, we are told that the tick was in the red box, clearance denied or withdrawn. Now, that doesn't seem to me borderline. Were you aware that the tick was in the red box?
I have, before the government chose to publish it, I've never seen a form like that. And so if I may make 2 points to John, I certainly do not recall the way in which the UKSV findings were presented to me as being that definitive. As I say, it was briefed to me that they were leaning against, I think is the phrase I remember. But
leaning against is not the same as the decision. We are told that the decision, the recommendation, rather, from UKSV was clear. The recommendation was denial. It wasn't leaning, it was denial.
Well, you asked me what I heard in that meeting, and I'm trying to remember to the best of my ability. The other point, which I think in the way you've asked the question, you understand perfectly well, but just in case, that form is consumed differently in the Foreign Office and in half a dozen other departments than it is in other parts of the system. Those are recommendations and not decisions. And so what my team will have done, I'm sure, is break that down, go through the specific issues that have led UKSV to their concern, and then make an assessment as to whether they can be managed. And that's what came to me.
Your team did that. The meeting you had was only with the Director of Security, so it would have been his officials who had broken it down, and he would have reported to you the outcome of that process.
Right.
And a note was then circulated afterwards saying what the decision was. Did that note simply say it has been decided that Lord Mandelson is to be granted clearance, or did it say, despite the recommendation of UKSV, it has been decided?
I think that that minute is not a minute I can properly discuss, Sir John. It's no longer, sadly, my document. And as I said in answer to the chair's questions earlier, it's a minute that certainly would give you, the public, but also our adversaries, quite a strong sense of how we tried to manage that process.
But are you aware that anybody else other than you and the Director of Security who took that decision were aware outside that the decision went against the recommendation of UKSV?
Apologies for repeating myself, but I was told that it was borderline and that they were leaning against, recommending against. I don't remember anybody at any stage saying anything different to me, certainly not about red boxes. So I'm sorry, I don't know if that answers your question. But
I'm afraid it doesn't quite.
Okay,
essentially, my question is, you took a decision in a meeting with just one other person present. Was anybody else aware after that meeting that the decision had been to overturn or to go against the recommendation of UKSV? Or was it simply reported, we've had a meeting and we've decided that he should obtain clearance?
I'm sure the director, and sorry, I did answer the chair earlier. I don't think it was just the director in the meeting with me. I think there was at least one member of his team there. I'm sure they will have debriefed to some extent on the conversation, but I don't know precisely what was said.
Did you tell ministers at all, or number 10? You told them the outcome of your decision, the outcome of the meeting, but did you tell them about the recommendation made by UKSD?
No, and months and months later, when in the immediate aftermath of Mandelson's sacking, we were obviously thinking internally about how to respond to legitimate questions this committee and others had about that process. And my recollection is, in a way, I wasn't surprised by the direction from Number 10 was, we must make clear that these decisions were taken entirely independently of ministers and that they were not consulted other than to be told the outcome.
Edward, I think you wanted to intervene.
Moving around the panel probably gives us an opportunity to come out. We will, of course, be praising everything that you heard. They're focusing again pretty much on the process and how close Sir Keir Starmer was or was not to the affair. Let's take a quick break for news. 9:47, LBC News headlines. Dominic Ellis.
The former boss of the Foreign Office has accused Downing Street of taking a dismissive approach to the vetting of Lord Mandelson. A teenage boy has been charged in connection with an arson attack on a synagogue in North London on Saturday. And Iran's chief negotiator has cast fresh doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the United States will go ahead later. LBC weather dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for the north of Scotland, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC Travel, I'm Joanne Webb. There are delays on the M1 in both directions to Junction 11 at Dunstable South. It's because a lorry's broken down southbound and there was an accident earlier northbound. Also, severe delays on the M25 anti-clockwise. It's slow for about an hour to the Dartford Tunnel from Junction 4 at Orpington. Also on the M25, it's very busy clockwise at Junction 24 at Potter's Bar where a car's broken down. On the Underground, well, the strike starts at midday, but already there are severe delays on the Circle Line clockwise, and that's because of the strike. And no Mildmay line running between Wilson Junction and Richmond, but that was after the fire alarms went off earlier at South Acton.
Coming up at 10 on LBC, James O'Brien.
Dear five of the Ollie Robbins, Peter Mandelson, Keir Starmer debacle. Has anything changed this morning? And the phones ban in schools. It's happening, but do we need it?
James O'Brien at 10. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. And right now, we've got some great deals for you to make the most of. So secure your family holiday with just a £60 deposit per person. And get the best choice of free child place holidays. Don't miss out. Book now. Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. Package holidays you can trust. Up supranatural protected, subject to availability and conditions.
Call Nick Ferrari now, 0345 6060 973. This is LBC.
Dating apps? Easy. Online shopping? Simple. Banking app? Sorted. Life admin? Ugh. That's what a digital ID could change. And the government is opening a conversation to make it work for you. Your voice will shape the final product. So search Digital ID Consultation to have your say. Digital ID, making public services work for you.
Your time is valuable. Your perspective should be too. The Economist cuts through the noise with the stories that truly shape your world.
How can you believe that a new regime won't crush you just like the previous one?
Online scams are stranger than they've ever been.
When the world's turned upside down, know which way is up. Read, watch, or listen to The Economist.
At Pets in a Pickle, we're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Here's a bright idea. Let Wix see how much you could save on your electricity bills. With Wix Solar, our team handles everything under the sun, from design to the perfect installation of your solar panels. We're proud as a peacock to be rated excellent on Trustpilot, so you can feel confident your solar installation is in safe hands. Book your free solar appointment today at wix.co.uk. Wix Solar, a name you can trust with service you can rely on.
Notice the change in your hearing? Well, get a hearing check from Specsavers. Oh, not sure where to start? Well, we're very flexible. Book one online, on the phone, on your lunch break, on Saturdays, on the same day if you're lucky. Oh, you only miss the odd word. But what if the odd words you're missing are nice ones like love you, or important ones like duck? Oh, too expensive, is it? All right, we like you. We'll do it for nothing. For free hearing checks, should have gone to Specsavers.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Well, with this extraordinary level of alleged political wrongdoings and possibly mixed messages, it takes something to come away from that live evidence. But this is a pretty special day, because today would have been the birthday of the girl who started life as Lilibet but went on to be Queen Elizabeth II. Now, in honour of the occasion, the King, Queen Camilla visited an exhibition celebrating her fashion sense. That was at Buckingham Palace yesterday. And LBC's Helen Hoddenott takes a look back at the defining moments of our former monarch's life.
How big is your palace?
My palace is quite large. It has very long corridors to walk down it.
Elizabeth Alexandra Mary Windsor was born on the 21st of April, 1926. Affectionately nicknamed Lilibet, she delivered her first broadcast during World War II when she was just 14 years old, a message to child evacuees.
To you, living in new surroundings, we send a message of true sympathy.
Years later, she would remember slipping out of Buckingham Palace on the day of victory in Europe.
I remember we were terrified of being recognised. We cheered the King and Queen on the balcony and then walked miles through the streets.
Queen Elizabeth II was crowned in June 1953. 4 years later, she delivered the first ever televised Royal Christmas address, moving on from radio as new technologies became mainstream.
My own family often gather round to watch television, and that is how I imagine you now.
1992 was a self-declared low point for the Queen. Three of her children separated from their spouses. The family was plagued by scandal in the tabloids, and her beloved childhood home caught fire.
Fire and rescue.
There's Windsor Castle here.
Yeah.
We've got a fire in the fire at Chapel at Windsor Castle.
A few days later, she delivered her most personal speech to date.
In the words of one of my more sympathetic correspondents, it has turned out to be an annus horribilis.
Then, in 1997...
A short while ago, Buckingham Palace confirmed the death of Diana, Princess of Wales.
In the aftermath of the tragedy, the Queen was accused of indifference, with papers running front pages imploring her to show that she cared. She responded with a public address.
We have all been trying in our different ways to cope. It is not easy to express a sense of loss, since the initial shock is often succeeded by a mixture of other feelings.
The royal family then spent years rebuilding their relationship with the public, with a turning point often seen as the 2002 Golden Jubilee, opened by Brian May performing on the roof of Buckingham Palace. 2012 saw the Queen rubbing shoulders with 007 to mark the London Olympics.
Good evening, Sir Bond.
Good evening, Your Majesty.
COVID hit, and the Queen's address to the public conjured a wartime spirit of resilience.
We will be with our families again. We will meet again.
The Queen's final years were marked by the loss of her husband, Prince Philip, and declining mobility. But she continued to work until just 2 days before her death, when she formally appointed Liz Truss as Prime Minister as her last public duty.
You're listening to a special programme from LBC reflecting on the very sad news today that Queen Elizabeth II has died at the age of 96.
And that was my LBC colleague, of course, Sheila Fogarty, concluding Helen Hoddenott's report. And now, to mark this, and we're going to play it in full, a grieving message from a king to his mama.
Today, as we mark what would have been my beloved mother's 100th birthday, my family and I pause to reflect on the life and loss of a sovereign who meant so much to us all, and to celebrate anew the many blessings of her memory. Queen Elizabeth's promise with destiny kept, shaped the world around her, and touched the lives of countless people across our nation, the Commonwealth, and beyond. Her near century was one of remarkable change, and yet, through each passing decade, through every transformation, she remained constant, steadfast, and wholly devoted to the people she served. Millions will remember her for moments of national significance, many others for a fleeting personal encounter, a smile, a kind word that lifted spirits, or for that marvellous twinkle of the eye when sharing a marmalade sandwich with Paddington Bear in the final months of her life. Much about the times we now live in, I suspect, may have troubled her deeply, but I take heart from her belief that goodness will always prevail and that a brighter dawn is never far from the horizon. For, as a young Princess Elizabeth put it in her first ever public broadcast, aged just 14, we can each play our part to make the world of tomorrow a better and happier place. It is a belief which I share with all my heart. So, young or old, and whatever our differences, let us therefore seek to follow this example as we make today not the marking of a milestone felt by absence, but the celebration of a life well lived and a legacy of hope as we strive together towards a better, happier tomorrow, one rooted in peace, justice, prosperity and security. In this, I renew my own solemn pledge of duty and service to you all. God bless you, darling Mama. You remain forever in our hearts and prayers.
Moving message from King Charles. He says, much about the times we now live in, I suspect, may have troubled her deeply. I'm sure Ukraine, Iran and others, but hinting at his brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, hinting at his own son, Prince Harry, hinting possibly at the diagnosis for him and, of course, for Kate as well. So much on which the Queen would have had to reflect. 100 years born today. And that's it from us. If you missed any of the show, listen back on our free Global Player or the LBC app, where you can also stay up to date with all the latest news, videos and opinions. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. I'm done. James O'Brien's the other side of the news on LBC. I'm back with you tomorrow morning from 7. Meantime, stay safe.
Thank you, Nick. The time is approaching 10 o'clock, and if you're quiet,
you might just be able to detect the sound of a pendulum swinging. I have to confess to you, I don't know this morning whether I am coming or going. I found Ollie Robbins's testimony, if that is the correct word to use, both compelling and sympathetic. I think he might be a man more sinned against than sinning. But the central platform of his evidence seems to be that he was confident, as a lifelong civil servant with a very good reputation, that they could happily accommodate and or overcome the misgivings that led to Peter Mandelson's developed vetting failing. So why did he get sacked? And big question, how important is this now?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the former boss of the Foreign Office has accused Downing Street of taking a dismissive approach to the vetting of Peter Mandelson. Sir Ollie Robbins is giving evidence to MPs this morning after his department was accused of waving through concerns flagged by a security review. Sir Keir Starmer insists he was kept in the dark over Lord Mandelson's vetting ahead of the peer being made US ambassador. Sir Ollie's been telling the Foreign Affairs Select Committee that there was a focus on getting Lord Mandelson to Washington quickly.
I walked into a situation in which there was already a very, very strong expectation coming from Number 10 that he needed to be in post and in America as quickly as humanly possible. The very first formal communication of this to my predecessor from Number 10 private office being that they wanted all this done at pace and Mandelson in post before inauguration.
Stay with LBC for the very latest. A 17-year-old boy has been charged with arson following an attack on a synagogue in North London. The Kenton United Synagogue in Harrow was targeted on Saturday night. The teenager, who's a British national and can't be named because of his age, is due before Westminster magistrates today. Iran's chief negotiator has cast new doubts on whether a second round of peace talks with the United States will go ahead in Pakistan later. Mohammed Baghir Ghalibaf says Tehran won't accept negotiations under the shadow of threats from America. The ceasefire between Iran and the US is due to expire tomorrow. The UK's unemployment rate fell to 4.9% in the 3 months to February. The fall was unexpected, with many experts predicting that the rate would remain unchanged at 5.2%. And the King has released a message remembering his late mother, Queen Elizabeth II, on what would have been her 100th birthday.
Her near century was one of remarkable change, and yet through each passing decade, through every transformation, she remained constant, steadfast, and wholly devoted to the people she served.
In the video, Charles suggested that his late mother would have been troubled by some current events, but would have also looked for the positives. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 7 at 10,616. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, dry and sunny for large parts of the UK. Some outbreaks of rain for northern Scotland with a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
You know what you're getting with a wedding? Wedding hats. A baby in a waistcoat crying throughout the vows. Themed tables. Awkward best man speech. The plus one.
Hello.
People dancing in a circle. Ruined rental suit. Sometimes in life you just know what you're getting. Like a luxury bed and a great night's sleep. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. It is 3 minutes after 10, and I hope this doesn't come as a major surprise to you. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. It's quite nice some mornings to have the live cover. It doesn't happen very often. It's a mark of how significant a moment is. And then, of course, you have the little voice in your head that starts wondering how significant a moment this actually is. And then you have, the problem I have now is Natasha Clark is in the studio. Nothing personal, Natasha, but when the political editor arrives here, it is evidence that in Westminster, this is huge. And I need a little bit of help from Natasha imminently to make sense of exactly what has happened this morning. But the question I have for you is an amalgam. What do they call it? The young people? A mashup. If you were to take Friday's show and yesterday's show and do what the young people call a mashup, poosh. I don't know if that sound effect is appropriate or accurate. And frankly, who cares? You do a mashup of Friday's show and Monday's show. You're left with a slightly odd question given the amount of coverage, airtime and attention that this story continues to receive. Am I embarrassed to tell you? No, I'm not embarrassed to tell you this. I'm quietly proud of my honesty. I don't know how important this story is anymore. I have been blown around like a feather in a Morrison's shop doorway. I have no idea how important this story is anymore. The question of whether or not Peter Mandelson should have been sent to Washington in the first place is actually not answered by the events of this morning or yesterday or Friday, and isn't really relevant to the question that I'm about to ask you. Everybody thinks it was an appalling idea now, but spoiler alert, at the time, everybody thought it was a brilliant idea. Don't at me to tell me that you didn't think it was a brilliant idea. I am speaking generically. I am generalizing. Everyone thought it was a brilliant idea until it was an appalling idea. I can't think of a better example of a unanimous, a nationwide reverse ferret than that one. Everybody thought it was a brilliant idea until everybody suddenly thought it was an appalling idea. And, of course, the heart of that particular conundrum is the one that we identified yesterday. The reason why it was an appalling appointment is the same reason why it was a brilliant appointment. You can't get past that. That is my gift to you during these complicated and complex times. My gift to you, and if you are lucky enough to know people that never listen to this program, you can pass it off as your own sparkling insight. The reason why this story is so bizarre is because the reason why Peter Mandelson's appointment was brilliant is the same reason why Peter Mandelson's appointment was appalling. And then you come to the role of Ollie Robbins and the question of vetting, which has, if anything, this morning become to me more confusing now than it was before. Because did he actually fail the vetting in the conventional clear sense that we have been told now for the best part of a week that he didn't, that he did indeed fail the vetting? And I don't know the answer to that question. I've got two thoughts. The first thought is that the smoking gun with regard to Mandelson's appointment is not as smoky as it was before, and that Ollie Robbins looks increasingly like a man more sinned against than sinning. And that is not a moment. That is a incremental issue. That is about Keir Starmer's judgment, his petulance, his rush to judgment, and his attempt to avoid responsibility for almost anything. Sack him! Sack him! Sack him! Feels increasingly like a knee-jerk reaction to events that, under Ollie Robbins' account this morning, actually seem to be fairly straightforward and fairly sympathetic. And the thing I said to you yesterday, I think I said this to Natasha off-air, but I said it to you on-air, is that there must have been a conversation that essentially circled this particular drain. He's already been a member of the Privy Council for God knows how long. He's been a Secretary of State. He's held all manner of massive jobs, albeit that he's had to resign them from them for lying. Why do we need to vet this guy? If we're vetting him for this job, how could he have held all the previous jobs? Do you see what I mean? Turns out that conversation was indeed had and contributed to what Ollie Robbins has described as a, shall we say, an unseemly enthusiasm, or he uses the phrase a dismissive approach to vetting from Number 10, which I can sort of understand as well. Would we, before we turn to Natasha, would you like to hear an early entrant into Idiot's Corner this morning? Because someone's come out of the blocks at 100 miles an hour, and it is an example of idiocy on at least two levels. So on Friday, I thought Starmer was 52-48 to lose his job. Yesterday, and should have done, I was so, I don't even know what the correct word is, just betrayed almost, let down by the idea that they'd sent someone to Washington, D.C. who failed security vetting. 3 hours of radio on Friday, dancing around that particular maypole. Then over the course of the weekend, my position shifted a bit, but to be honest with you, I was too busy basking in the joy of the best concert I think I've ever been to spend too much time worrying about Ollie Robbins, Peter Mandelson or Keir Starmer. But by the time we got on air yesterday, I did find myself wondering whether we'd fallen into a trap of thinking that this was a story of rather more significance than it actually was. And today I'm caught between the two positions. But our entry into Mid-Idiot's Corner has been in touch to say, how did we now, James, would try and downplay this? And you did hear that correctly. How did we now, James, would try and downplay... Now, it could be that my correspondent is from the Black Country, and they don't realise that the word no actually begins with a K. Or it could be that they're as thick as mints. I'm going to go with the latter. 9 minutes after 10 is the time. Natasha Clark is here. What did we learn this morning?
James, I think we've learned a lot this morning, actually. It has been quite a revelatory session that Sir Ollie